But meanwhile, most people are acting some of the...
Well, particularly, you know, the Uber center.
So that, I don't think that there's that much they can be done about it.
And we didn't do the...
But it's, in my mind, it is a consideration. I do think that that would be... I'm trying to participate with that.
How did you do those?
I've seen some mail messages, NCBI people are sending.
I think it was just a text.
And they made the statement that FEMA ARPA had never deposited. And that's just, that's insane, because Tiger is the primary of a very large one that goes to GenBank, and then the GenBank records. You know, the world is this big, huge gravel and you can then hang it like this and say, that's the best.
I never saw it going in this
morning. And somehow we're all like, I was the best. So we're just
walking through the hydrant like morning.
Silly issue. This is all sort of a type of plastic type of competition.
And a lot of this is going to be...
And fortunately, people like Valentina are not in state. So actually, just not place NCBI or RESI, very high.
We just need to...
They don't think that. So all data is just waiting up to. So,
you know, it's the same situation, again, because
Let me just explain the order of events. I will talk for an hour, giving some basic background to everything else which is taking place, into which the disease ontology should ideally fit. And I will be teasing you towards what I think is the correct definition of disease. Then Neil Williams, who is a philosophy colleague of mine from Buffalo, will fill in some of the philosophical background which is needed in order to understand the point of that definition. And then, in the second part, we will test the definition against the kinds of problems that we were addressing in connection with Rex's talk this morning. And the first thing which I think that needs to be said very, very clearly is that the disease space is part of a much larger space, both of which are continua. They are full of continuous boundaries. And disease itself is not going to have a clear, sharp boundary. There is going to be no sharp definition of disease, in just the same way that there is no sharp definition of red or yellow, because red and yellow merge into each other. But we have a theory of color nonetheless. And if people had worried about the existence of these non-sharp boundaries as much as we worry about the non-sharp boundary around disease, then we would never have developed that theory of color. So colors form a continuum, but this is a prototyped continuum. And the fact that colors form a prototype continuum is shown by the fact that we have lexicalizations for certain color phenomena, like red, but we don't have lexicalizations for certain other kinds of color phenomena. Now, it turns out that the focal color instances of red are cross-cultural. They're the same everywhere, even though different cultures have different boundaries around red. And we should take a lesson from this and focus on the foci. If we want to understand the universals of color categorization, we will get nowhere if we focus on boundaries, because there are no universals. But we will turn out to have very good theories if we focus on the prototypes or the typical cases. So we focus on typical red, typical yellow, typical indigo, and so on. And we will end up with the theory of color categorization, which has become an established part of linguistics and cognitive science in the last 20 years or so.
The point why there are foci in this field is because our perceptive apparatus has some, you know...
It doesn't matter. The general lesson is that we should not worry about boundary. We should worry about the focal instances.
But the, as I just said, the our cognitive apparatus
doesn't matter,
and not with reality.
Doesn't matter. The reason why we have foci in one domain or in another domain is irrelevant to the fact that there are foci.
Why would you assume that there are foci?
Because we have lexicalizations in the disease domain.
But you
and the reason why we have those...
Disease, excuse me, sir, I'm going to ask you to let him finish.
My argument is that you have foci in the color space because our perceptive apparatus is, you know, the way all the it works leads to this foci, and so you can focus on that because they are invariant across cultures because culture has nothing to do with how our brain works basically. This won't work for diseases. The diseases you have, or at least I don't see why there should be any perceptive.
So I am suggesting that it will work. It will enable us to get over a big hurdle, which is that people keep arguing about the boundaries of disease.
Yes, but where
and you're
the
doing it yourself.
Point come from?
Etiology could be a focal point.
So that doesn't matter. It may matter later, but it doesn't matter now. I'm not going to use focus as a technical term. I'm going to use this as an argument that we stop worrying about boundaries. Boundaries are very difficult in complicated domains which are characterized by continua. We wouldn't have geometry if we didn't focus on squares and lines and triangles and circles, but rather try to focus on the entire continuum of all possible shapes. It's a very simple recommendation as to how we should proceed. It's not a theory about foci or cognition or a disease, kind of that.
I can give you a good formal description how in the various languages, depending on the number of color terms, you get to the boundaries. And I don't see anything...
But we would never have made progress with colors if we'd started with the boundaries, as is proved by the fact that we didn't until people realized that there were cross-cultural focal instances. Cross-culturally identical focal instances. Was there a...
I just wondered if you could give an example of something that might serve as a focal point in disease.
Disease? The term disease has focal instances.
But what would those be?
Diabetes, cancer,
okay.
Pneumonia. Simple as that. The short terms. Mm-hmm. So, there are two strategies for creating ontologies and terminologies which have been manifesting themselves for the last 30 years in the area of biomedicine. One strategy is illustrated by the UMLS, which and I take it is defended here in large part by Chris, which says each local community needs to develop its own terminology for its own specific local needs. There will therefore be many terminologies, and there will therefore be a difficulty in combining the data deriving from the relevant local groups. The other strategy is the strategy which is lying beneath the OBO Foundry initiative, which says that we need to create in a coordinated way based upon large-scale community consensus, following the model of the gene ontology, a system of interoperable high-quality reference ontologies. These reference ontologies should include the basic biomedical sciences, because clinical medicine increasingly is going to have to use data which derive from biochemistry and gene array experimentation and many other areas which are dealt with by the basic biomedical sciences. The idea is that the more we can get coordination in terminologies, even in clinical terminologies, the more the large amounts of different kinds of data deriving from these different sources will be interoperable. So the OBO Foundry is designed as a kind of common railway gauge. It's better to make your trains run long distances if you use just one gauge rather than many different local gauges. Chris?
Because you've chosen to classify me, Barry, I should point out most of my writing from the mid-90s talks about interlocking terminologies.
Good.
So
good.
I'm in category B.
Good. Now, one simple rule, which will give you an example of how easy this is that you should use single nouns, shouldn't you, Rex?
We're committed to doing it.
So you shouldn't have eight different ways of referring to the same D entity in the same ontology, because that will divide by a factor of eight the degree to which you can have your ontology be interoperable with other neighboring ontologies. You should all follow the same rules. And the rules are very often as simple as this. Now, I think that strategy B, to which Chris has allied himself, is more future-proof than strategy A. The more these basic biomedical data sources become more important to clinical medicine, the more clinical terminologies will need to be compatible with basic biomedical ontologies. And since we already have fairly decent basic biomedical ontologies, we should use them as the basis to build up to clinical ontologies, which means the disease ontology, or a family of disease ontologies, or a family of artifacts like that, as well as diagnosis ontologies and manifestation ontologies and so forth. Yes?
I think we're already almost there, because in clinical medicine, you have the laboratory diagnostic techniques, which are becoming more and more molecular-based,
yeah.
And anatomic pathology is already cellular-based, so
this,
we're already yeah. there.
So we already need to be present-proof, in other words. And our terminologies are not even present-proof. So the OBO Foundry is a subset of the OBO ontologies, which means that they are all open source. And the developers of these ontologies have all agreed in advance to accept a common set of principles, simple rules like the one I just illustrated, a set of principles which will gradually become more stringent, which are designed to ensure interoperability with the basic science ontologies and, in the long run, to supply support for ever more powerful logic-based reasoning. And the disease ontology wants to become a member of the OBO Foundry. That's the background for this. Ken.
Can I ask a question about the reason for the OBO's stance with respect to how it defines open? Because I think this will have an important defining relationship to what SNOMED is becoming.
Yeah.
And whether SNOMED is considered anathema or
yes.
not.
Yes. So
currently it's considered anathema because of
yes.
its restrictive
so
policies.
The OBO Foundry does not consider the things not inside the OBO Foundry necessarily as anathema. There are some things which should probably be considered as anathema, but not everything which is outside.
I'm overcharacterizing some
yes,
people's
attitudes. So the biologists have a long tradition of sharing data. The clinical medical world does not really have such a tradition.
Right.
In the biological world, it's taken for granted that everybody will share their data from the very start and want to share their data, and they will want to take other people's data onto their laptop and modify it slightly and then send it to someone else who can then do other things with it. That's what is meant by open. It means you can take your laptop with you when you go diving in the coral reefs, and you can do your coral work without needing to get a license from someone first.
I think you're taking the point of view towards clinical medicine that is pejorative. And I'd like to just...
No, I'm not. I didn't talk about clinical medicine in anything I just said.
You said that...
The tradition has been...
The tradition of scientists is to share data, and the tradition of clinicians is not to share data.
But I'd
like to just probe a little further on that, because I think there's an aspect of commonality for clinical data reporting that is necessary and that basically creates a requirement for a clinical terminology that it not be fragmented and that completely open terminology in clinical medicine will naturally become fragmented and lose its value. But I just wanted to see if that's...
So that is an interesting proposal. So in other words, you and I agree that SNOMED is a good thing to have, and it would be good if we had lots of data which is coded in SNOMED terms, and it would be even better if we had that data in such a way that other clinicians could use that data for their purposes,
right,
with as few restrictions as is possible given constraints on privacy. So we both agree with. Now you make a new thesis, which is that if that whole enterprise is entirely open, that will imply fragmentation, so that we will not have SNOMED, we will have lots of little fragmented.
Depending on what you mean by open.
Yes, and I don't understand that claim.
My understanding of what OBO says is that anyone can take these terminologies,
yeah,
and make their own version of it.
Okay,
and
good.
Publish
okay.
It and use
okay, good.
It and
yes,
say,
yes.
No, don't use that one, use
yes,
this one because
yes, good,
it's my new, refined, better,
good,
special
good,
version
good,
for this particular
yes. So, yes, you're right that there is that feature of openness. And the rule says that you're not allowed to use an OBO Foundry ontology under the same name. So if you want to use it, you're not allowed to change an OBO Foundry ontology and use it somewhere else under the same name. If you change it, you have to give it a new name. Now, that doesn't mean that we're encouraging people to take OBO Foundry ontologies, change them slightly, and give them new names. That would indeed defeat the very purpose. So the point of the OBO Foundry ontology, as you will see in a minute, is exactly opposite to that. It's just that the principle of openness means that we accept that this possibility will obtain. So we do not want to, we can't stop people taking open source ontologies and using them for other purposes. We just want to ensure that they then give them, if they change them in any way, they give them a new name. Not because we want them to change them, but because we want them to keep away from the OBO Foundry and to be conspicuously somewhere else.
What confidence can I have that we won't have fragmentation? Because fragmentation is the history of clinical terminology.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what
you have to
happens.
You have to trust the developers that they will actually follow through on their agreement. Their agreement is much more than this,
well,
as you will see in
the
minute.
They don't agree not to fragment, though.
We can put that rule in there. It's a good rule.
So if SNOMED's only restriction was that you not fragment, then from your perspective, this would be compatible with...
It has to follow the other rules, and I was not going to list them.
Assuming that it was freely available.
Yep.
I think we have to introduce the notion of reference ontology and applied ontology here. The open ontologies are considered to be reference ontologies, which means they are supposed to cover their domain completely, and there is not... that all ontologies are orthogonal to each other, so
I'll come to that.
Okay.
Anyway,
the point is that if somebody wants to do something for a specific purpose and get and create a new ontology, this would be an application ontology, and for this reason already wouldn't qualify as a new OBO reference ontology.
So I'll come to this issue of orthogonality in a minute. I'm sure that it will please him at least in part. Alan?
Just two things on the fragmentation. One, we have examples of biology ontologies that are not fragmented and are open. And secondly, it's not clear that fragmentation is always a bad thing. That if I want to develop a highly specialized ontology for some portion of cancer research, I may wish to have this well linked into SNOMED or something else.
Yep.
But I would certainly not want to be limited in what I did to what was in SNOMED, nor would I necessarily need all of SNOMED or anything like it. Yep. Using SNOMED, I might need only a small fragment.
Well, I would not argue against extensibility. I think what you're arguing for is extensibility, and I'm totally in favor of extensibility, but I'm against fragmentation, and I think there's a...
What do you mean by fragmentation?
Fragmentation is where you get two different coding systems that people are proposing for use in particular clinical domains.
Yeah, you will see that I'm completely on your side.
Where one group says, yeah, we're the experts in dermatology, you should use this coding system for your dermatologic diagnoses. And somebody else comes along and says, we're the experts in dermatopathology and you should use this coding system. And it turns out that they have overlap and they conflict.
Yeah, you'll see I'm on your side.
How do you prevent that?
By getting people to agree.
Well, if you make something that's really useful so that people don't need to redo the work, they will use it. That's the key, is to make it so that they don't go to it and say, it's all screwed up, I'm just going to make my own.
Right. So if you are building an ontology and you discover for whatever reason that it's all screwed up, then you should go to other people and work with them to find a better consensus solution.
Yes.
That's the idea behind the Ogilvie Fund.
The idea there should be some kind of impetus to make people fix or repair or come to consensus, rather than just simply say, well, that's not good enough, I have to do my own, I'm going to go off and do my own. Because in this room, we have already examples of at least four, or maybe five, or maybe six, different disease ontologies, all of which are independently created for different purposes, and there's been nothing to cause convergence. I think there ought to be convergence. That's where I really
think that Rex is in favor of convergence between the disease ontology and the relevant parts of SNOMED.
Yes.
And I've heard him say that.
I just wanted to make sure that the quote-unquote open phrase is understood as a functional thing, not as dogma.
That this is all functional.
Open means that I don't have to worry that if I put up something that has those terms in it, somebody's going to send me a letter and say, you shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
That's what open means.
Well, and so I think people have tended to use openness to mean many different things and as dogma, and I just argue against that.
Yeah. Okay, so these are some of the ontologies in the Ogilvie Foundry. The Ogilvie Foundry started with the gene ontology. And it's an attempt to mimic some of the successes of the gene ontology in functional applications, but across a wider scale, and ultimately to include also the clinical domain. And the gene ontology, as everyone in this room surely knows, consists of three constituent ontologies: cellular components, molecular functions, and biological processes. And this is the map of the Ogilvie Foundry ontologies, or at least the core of the Ogilvie Foundry ontologies, with the original gene ontologies in yellow. So the idea is that we have different granularities of molecule, cell, and organ, and we need for each of these ontologies both an ontology of the corresponding entities and of the functions and of the processes, which means, for instance, that we need cell ontology, a cellular component ontology, a cellular function ontology, the relevant quality phenotype ontologies, and then process ontologies. And these are the rules that you need to commit to if you want to join the Ogilvie Foundry. So it has to be available to be used by all in a non-dogmatic and highly functional sense. Everyone has to agree to collaborate with the other developers in all domains which overlap. So this is science now. You're not allowed to work in your own private place and do your thing. You're doing something which is part of a social endeavor. You have to create your ontology in a sufficiently rigorous way that it can be instantiated in a formal language, and we have a certain range of allowable formal languages. You have to have identifiers. You have to have a system for versioning so that we can guarantee backwards compatibility of data, which has been annotated using an ontology. There has to be a clearly delineated content. There have to be textual definitions for at least very many of the terms. You have to have a good documentation, which means that non-experts in ontology can understand what the ontology is for and what it contains. You have to have a plurality of users. There has to be a common architecture, which means at least using relations which are defined in a certain way. But most importantly, and this is exactly Kent's point, the ontologies have to be orthogonal to each other. And what that means is that the developers of OBO Foundry ontologies commit to the goal that there will be one ontology for every domain. Now, of course, how you define domains is going to be somewhat difficult, but we want to have convergence so that if you have three people, all of them working on immunology, for instance, then there will be one collection of terms organized in terms of one collection of relations, which all three of those groups will accept, or they will continue working until they reach the point where they all accept that one set of terms. And the reason for this has to do with the additivity of annotations. If we are annotating data, then we want to be assured that our annotations are going to be compatible with the annotations which are being created simultaneously by seven other communities, some of them working on mouse models, some of them working on molecular pathways, some of them working on clinical diagnosis. All of those annotations should be additive. And if the data looks like this, then we need to be assured that this kind of additivity is going to allow this data to be reasoned with by human beings, but also reasoned with by computers, which is the reason for the various computational constraints or logical constraints, constraints which are being tested and are being strengthened as we go on. So the goal is, and this is the goal underlying the OBO Foundry and the disease ontology, that when we annotate disease-related data, then we should be assured that the annotations we make using disease terms will at least be consistent with annotations which other people are making using basic science terms, biochemical terms, for instance. Which is why the OBO Foundry itself has to be a logically well-structured single system. Now, part of it is the foundational model of anatomy, which is an ontology of structures in the human body. And this is a small fragment of the FMA, which is organized. This particular fragment is organized using just the two relations, isar and partof. So the horizontal array here is a representation of partof relations between anatomical types. And then the vertical is the representation of isar relations. Now this ontology is a very well-structured ontology. There is no other ontology which is so well-structured as the FMA. No other large biomedical ontology which is so well-structured as the FMA. And the FMA also has very well-structured definitions which are based on an Aristotelian principle illustrated by this, and that human being is an animal which is rational. An A is a B which sees. This should be the form of our definitions, as for instance in a cell is an anatomical structure which, and so forth. This kind of definition turns out to be very easy to construct, and it turns out to avoid automatically all kinds of mistakes which people characteristically make when they create definitions for biomedical terms. And the FMA goes all the way down to subcellular entities. The gene ontology has some of the same advantages as the FMA. So indeed it goes further than the FMA in that it's cross species. I think one of the main reasons for the success of the gene ontology is that it is an ontology consisting of terms which apply to many species. It's also cross granularity, and it also has impressive policies for maintenance. That is to say, it's kept up to date on the basis of user input in a very impressive way. But it's full, or has been full, of all kinds of logically related incoherences and sloppiness. But gradually, a series of reforms has been instituted which are eliminating step by step these problems with earlier versions of the gene ontology. And the person who's doing a lot of that work just walked into the room. So, for instance, we are introducing Aristotelian definitions into the gene ontology. Granularity is being treated in a coherent way. We have ways of understanding the relations between the three ontologies, which we didn't have earlier, and so forth. Now, one thing which the gene ontology is still affected by is multiple inheritance, which is a topic which caught our attentions a lot this morning. So this is not a good ontology. It would be an incoherent instruction to tell somebody to do an assay of the cars going underneath a certain bridge by telling them to list all the blue cars, all the blue things and all the cars. They would not get a usable, useful, statistically significant, or any other kind of representation of cars going under that bridge on this basis. This is just not a good way to classify things. Now, I think that multiple inheritance always involves exactly this kind of incoherence, and that therefore multiple inheritance should be avoided.
I didn't understand that.
And let me start again. Supposing you want to know what cars are going underneath a certain bridge. You have a specific use for this information. So you give this instruction to your car observer. You say
what things or what vehicles, not what cars.
What things.
Otherwise your example doesn't work.
I think that the example works whatever you put there, but I'm happy to change thing to vehicle. So you tell him to bring you an assay of the vehicles going underneath. And he comes back with a list of the blue vehicles and a list of the cars. There were 276 cars and 47 blue vehicles. You would be very disappointed, because you would know much too little about what was going on in the bridge. If he came back with a list of all of the different colored vehicles, you may be somewhat happy. If he came back with a list of all the types of vehicles, you would be somewhat happy. But if he came back with just that list, you would be unhappy.
I'm sure I'm dense, but I don't understand how that makes multiple inheritance.
Because multiple inheritance necessarily involves double counting, first of all. There are other reasons, but that's the first reason. That's what it means.
Double counting is a good thing.
Double counting is...
Depending on your purpose.
So you can always, as Alan would be able to tell us at great length, you can always get those purposes realized from single inheritance ontologies by putting together the single inheritance ontologies for those purposes. So we can get these purposes by having a classification of colors and a classification of things or vehicles, and then you can make annotations like this: car number 2947 is blue. You can get that information from two separate single inheritance ontologies.
You're conflating, Barry, the goal of a statistical classification with the goal of a well-formed terminology, I submit. And I further would say that the example is strained because it's an incomplete instance. If you wanted to answer the question vehicles, then you would have a vehicle inheritance, and car could be a vehicle, truck could be a vehicle, and so on and so forth. But you go to the question you're asking, which is vehicle. The fact that there are blue cars is irrelevant to the question you posed.
I'm assuming that someone makes a mistake.
Why assume you have an ill-formed ontology?
Because I think that multiple inheritance ontologies are ill-formed. that making multiple inheritance ontologies is a mistake. It's, you get this. This is the information that you wanted. You wanted a list, assuming that you did want this information. Then you wanted a list of assertions like this: cars which are blue, trucks which are green, and
not
so forth.
Now you've just dipped your toes into the information model terminology model issue. You've asserted a compositional expression and an implicit information model. And the whole point of the term info exercise, as you well know, is trying to marry the, if you will, an ontology of an information model with an ontology of, as explicitly represented in a terminology, and to deflate these things, Alan is going to correct me, of course, but to deflate these things serves an artificial purpose.
So this was meant to be an artificial example to get to illustrate a problem which is quite general. Alan?
Well, the most serious problem with this, the issue aside, is the example's wrong. Can you go back to the example? It's just simply wrong. The thing at the bottom would be something that was blue and car. And the thing that you actually got, the thing that you got out of the list of that would be a list of blue cars. Now that might or might not be what you wanted, but you wouldn't get a list of the thing. In the normal meaning of inheritance, the thing that you would get would not be a list of things that were blue or cars, but a list of things that is blue and cars. So there are all sorts of arguments, but this particular presentation doesn't,
yeah, so
doesn't address them.
Maybe the story I told was somewhat incoherent. I'm not sure. I want to try again. That what you give someone the instruction to count the vehicles going underneath the bridge, and he comes back with a list with two columns. On the one column is blue vehicles, and on the other column is cars.
But that's not what's represented by the board. That isn't that item. That what
yes,
I'm
all right. So
nothing
yes,
to do
yes.
With
so
that.
I agree. But if he did come back with those two lists, that would not be a coherent way of addressing that goal.
No, but the result of that is to have blue or car, that he's actually produced blue or car, not blue and car, which inherits from neither blue nor car.
Yes, so it's hard to think of incoherent examples. Which don't collapse into incoherence.
I mean, it might well be, if I take another example, that I was quite happy to have somebody come back with a list that included diesel vehicles, petrol vehicles, cars, and lorries.
Yeah, but that would just be then a single inheritance hierarchy underneath vehicle.
Not necessarily, no. I've got two out there, petrol versus diesel.
Yes.
And car versus lorry.
Okay, and then I would submit that...
And I perfectly well have four categories that I explode out of that, and in which there are characteristics which I inherit from the fact that they're diesel vehicles, like
yeah.
I put diesel fuel in them, and if you put petrol in them, they don't work very well. And if there are things that I inherit from them being a car or a lorry, which is how much, whether I use them to carry freight or passengers by default. So, I mean, I think there are real questions here, but I think this particular example is most unfortunate.
I agree. Let's move on. So, I need to say one more thing about this example. The reason why it's a problem, or one reason why it's a problem, is that there is our relations here are distinct. And this is the problem which has been named by Nicola Guarino, Izar overloading. If you're using Izar to mean different things in different ontologies, then you are thereby thwarting the degree to which you can unify the data which is annotated in the terms of those ontologies. The gene ontology originally had at least three different meanings of part of. They were using part of to mean different things. Now they have just one meaning for part of, which means that the gene ontologies, three ontologies, are more compatible with each other.
In which sense are this different Izar relations? Because Izar just means every instance of blue car is a car, and every...
No, Izar means... Izar means that...
...is an instance of blue thing.
No, Izar means in one reading that, in another meaning it means that, and the terms designated by the terms of the Izar relation are... the entities designated by the terms of the Izar relation are types, which I'm coming to. So the car is a type, blue thing is not a type, neither is blue vehicle.
But to get back to a case such as diabetes being a disease of glucose metabolism and autoimmune disease.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there it's an and it would be very consistent with what we've heard. And the only, if I'm understanding correctly, the concern that you have is that they reconnect back up the top with disease. So maybe if you broke that, then...
No, no, the problem with multiple inheritance is only this. Whether they reconnect up there is neither here nor there.
So
if you keep them apart as here, everything is fine, or as here.
So then what's the problem with having...
So I'll give you use that example. I want to be able to infer about autoimmune diseases in general. If I go up that other branch with type 1 diabetes, now I'm in, you know, diseases of glucose metabolism, and I'm going the wrong direction.
But if you go from the top, you'll get to the right place.
But I'm always going from the bottom up. Whenever I'm trying to, at least in my for my purposes, it's usually that direction. And I don't know which way to go to infer my relationships.
You would know by virtue of semantic type.
But then there are different relationships.
Anyway,
I think in one case we're talking about a difference in etiology, which is autoimmune disease. In another case, it's a difference in physiology, which is a manifestation of the disease.
There's
no argument about your needing to know which way you're going.
Right.
It's that actually, if you maintain things as different as autoimmune disorder and glucose metabolism, you're very unlikely to encounter conflicting things on those two lines. You may. But on the whole, it's very unlikely that the same things come down from two different orthogonal hierarchies. Different things happen on the different ones. So as long as you can tell which they are, which is perfectly possible, then it's not a problem. The thing you need to know is what's true of all your autoimmune diseases, or conceivably what's true of this because it's an autoimmune disease, and what's true of this because it's a disease of it's a disease of glucose metabolism or whatever the choice was. That's what we need to distinguish. And the question, we need to keep the means and the ends separate. That's a very clear and necessary end. It's not clear what the best means, that the means here are not over-constrained to meet the ends.
So in this case, the question is, do you need to have those in separate ontologies, or could they be in the same?
How do you coordinate those? This is a very clear statement of requirement. That you need to be able to. The usual thing which is worried about is that you actually get conflicts coming down. And indeed, if you don't have a clearly set of orthogonal ontology, you will get conflicts.
Yes.
The argument in favor of multiple inheritance that I'm so persuaded by is that you're forced to make arbitrary decisions, and when it comes to enumeration and counting, you're sometimes missing cases because they were put in the other pile. And the poster child example is gastric cancer. I used this example this morning. Is it a GI disease? Yes. Is it a cancer? Yes. Well, in the ICD, which is a statistical classification, it's not a GI disease because they put it in the cancer chapter. Therefore, you miss it if you try to go down a GI disease
so
pathway.
It's clearly another constraint on all of this work that we do not lose information in that way.
Then you have to have multiple.
No.
Difference is between what is your primary axis of classification and the ways in which you can kind of coordinate it and put it together. I think Ellen can probably express it better than that. But you can still define it using a single axis, but you define it in such a way that you're using this other orthogonal ontology so that you can automatically infer it's a GI disease.
But that becomes very arbitrary.
You're making this assumption. I think that part of this meeting is to find out whether that assumption is correct.
Which assumption?
That imposing a single inheritance hierarchy in classifying diseases would imply making an arbitrary choice.
Well, but so in the case that we're talking about, either the GI cancer case or the diabetes case.
No, because if we can cope with the GI-ness of this, in another ontology, which is single inheritance, which is actually something you're very close to doing already, then we would have a non-arbitrary way of addressing Chris's need without committing multiple inheritance. Let me explain, go through.
Yeah, I'd have to explain that. Does it seem, I mean... Explain what's the difference between having multiple ISAs and dealing with it in another computational way. I mean, it's you know,
If we have a forest of single inheritance ontologies, we can put them together to create multiple inheritance ontologies in well understood ways for specific purposes.
Okay.
So if you have a real need
so
for multiple
in favor of multiple inheritance.
No, I'm saying that you can do it. But why should you create your multiple inheritance ontologies as application ontologies, to use the word that Fabian introduced?
Oh, I see.
Rather than you produce your multiple inheritance ontologies as your beginning reference ontology.
So then by definition, a disease ontology is going to have to be an application ontology.
That would be one solution. I think that it's too early to make that decision. So let me give you some reasons why I think multiple inheritance is to be avoided. First of all, it's demonstrably a source of errors. So ontologies which use multiple inheritance made errors more often than not in connection with multiple inheritance parts of the hierarchy. Because the people who were responsible for creating those ontologies were unsure about what the meanings of the ISA relation were when making the relevant decisions. So this is just an empirical fact.
There are lots of sources of errors.
Multiple inheritance ontology is harder to maintain than a single inheritance ontology. For different reasons. One reason is that a single inheritance ontology gives you a recipe for formulating definitions and for checking definitions and for checking that the definitions are compatible with the hierarchy itself. If you have multiple inheritance, you don't have that recipe because you don't know what the relevant parent term is in terms of which to define the relevant...
I would just say that the experience that SNOMED had when it used a single inheritance hierarchy was that the results were actually harder to maintain, and there were reasons for that. Pragmatically, yeah. There may be, in fact, a very large body of, terminology where it's easier to maintain in single inheritance and then combine separately.
Yeah.
But there are also circumstances where it's in fact easier to maintain if you just.
That may be one solution with regard to the disease ontology case. So it may be that the disease domain is such that it's an exception to this rule that single inheritance ontologies are easier to maintain. But that, too, is an empirical thesis that we need to test.
There's two points out of this. One of the things that comes out of this discussion is that however we do the disease ontology, there must be a means of dealing with the many diseases that fall into more than one class.
Of course, yes.
That's a requirement. The other thing that responds to Kent's point is that some of the issues is a matter of tooling.
Yep.
And it actually, different tools make this easier or more difficult in different frameworks. And that you can build tools which make it extremely difficult to do things in single hierarchies.
Yes.
And I think we need to be, personally, I think we need to be very careful of an over-reliance on tool-based solutions. I think it needs to be clear conceptually for anybody that's using it that this isn't only dependent on one tool that somebody has written.
No, I agree with that entirely.
And I think that's
feature. But I would adapt the tools to the clean conceptual solution, not the other way around.
So it should be intelligible to human users. And if a single inheritance hierarchy was more complicated in other ways than a tangled multiple inheritance hierarchy, so complicated that human beings couldn't navigate through it naturally, then that would be defeating the purpose. So another problem is that multiple inheritance contravenes orthogonality. A third problem is that you have no coherently defined levels within the ontology, which addresses Chris's point. For a statistical classification, you need to have coherently defined levels of jointly exhaustive and pairwise disjoint classes. And a multiple inheritance hierarchy does not give you that. A single inheritance hierarchy can give you that. Yes?
No.
In biology, the jointly exhaustive, pairwise disjoint statement just doesn't work.
So
we do not have exhaustive. You can get the disjoint, but not the exhaustive.
Yeah, I agree.
We do not have a serious fault in a number of ontologies, which really, and the reason for jumping is that in order to maintain that ends up with residual categories.
So I think the FMA does pretty well, actually.
It probably does, but I'm willing to. I would be very surprised, and I know Cornelius would never maintain that he could guarantee that every list in the FMA was complete.
No, but.
And anatomy is probably the thing we can be most complete on.
We should nevertheless embrace this criterion in the work that we do, even though we know that in biology we will probably rarely realize
it. I think you have to defend that very. There's no. Why? I know it's a matter of dogma from a long time, and I don't want to just start too. I'll just put down a marker at this point. But the mutually disjoint, I think you can make a good case for, or at least for being cautious on. But the fact that in most natural things our lists are open is something which I think we actually need to embrace rather than deny.
But you wouldn't want to embrace the line that we now stop and decide we're not going to add any more because we're not aiming for. Anyway.
No, absolutely not. No, okay, what I don't want to do is say that this is complete, so I cannot.
Yeah, but that's anymore. So we agree that we should aim for completeness relative to whatever the level is.
Yeah, but I should. When you say complete, you are saying that I can reason from not A and not B and not C to the last one in the list.
No,
I can never do.
I think that's even
the meaning of the word.
Yeah,
if you say those words, jointly exhaustive and pairwise disjoint. Then, if I have that, I can make that inference.
Yeah.
And that is an inference which is never justified in a biological, or almost never justified in the case of biological independent entities.
So, I agree with you. I think that it is justified with regard to some parts of the FMA. But I hope you agree with me that that should be our aim.
No, I don't.
Well, we've gone around this circle.
Go back. I think it is a.
Well, we try to do that inference all the time with the understanding we have incomplete information.
It's called
and
science.
It may not be absolutely correct, but it's as close as we can get.
Science never rests.
If you make that statement, you are introducing axioms which are false.
No. I said aim.
Okay. Well, if it becomes an aim, that's fine. If it becomes an axiom in your ontology, then it is a problem.
And it becomes an axiom if you will not allow an ontology to have those when it's deemed necessary.
There were too many negatives in that question.
Do you agree that they should be disjoint?
In general, they should be disjoint.
That's the multiple inheritance.
Yeah, exactly.
But where possible, we should be disjoint. And there may be a few exceptions to that. But it's the exhaustiveness, because I think there are important cases where the sorts of inference we want to do, and the limitations on that inference depend on whether we are dealing with an open list or a closed list. And therefore, I think we should actually pay attention to that. There are cases that are closed, and there are others that are open. I think those actually have formal differences in the way we express the ontologies and represent them. So I'll put that down as a marker.
There's no disagreement at all. So we both agree. All right. So the disease ontology at the moment is full of multiple inheritance like this, which means that we cannot recognize coherent levels. So there is an attempt here to create levels. But in fact, since the distance between terms along any given branch is different according to which branch you follow, we don't have coherent levels.
There is no attempt to create levels here.
Okay,
that's
so purely visual. All right.
And
so
just to be fair, I think SNOMED would have exactly the same issue.
Could you go back to the nice graph here? So
This is Alzheimer's disease, in case you can't read it. Sorry?
Alzheimer's disease is a rheumatism.
Yes, I thought that was a bit strange.
Yeah, it's an error, definitely.
Yeah. In fact, I think I emailed you about this.
Not about that one, but it's an error.
Good.
There's one other problem with multiple inheritance is you get ontology explosion very quickly. Because when you start talking about a red car and a blue car and then a large red car and a large blue car and a large small blue car.
So, and that's why also it's a good idea to maintain these things separately. Because you can have a classification of sizes, you can have a classification of colors, you can have a classification of tumors, and you get then all the information that you need by means of cross products. Where if you try and classify all tumors in terms of all possible shapes and sizes, then you'll be here all day. All right, so very quickly, there are three fundamental dichotomies which need to be borne in mind if you're going to build ontologies which do the job in a coherent way, it seems. The first is between types and instances. So an instance is a particular entity in spatiotemporal reality, like this laptop, or this particular waving of the arm. And a type is a general kind which is instantiated by an open-ended totality of such instances. And the instances are such that they share certain qualities and propensities of the sort that are documented in scientific literature. So types are what are represented in science texts. Science texts are about types like electron or cell or membrane or human or mouse. They are about what is general in reality. Clinical guidelines are representations of types in reality. You have clinical guidelines because you have the same types of cases over and over again, and you want to employ the same kinds of therapies over and over again. And ontologies are representations of types in reality. Ontologies capture the terminological skeleton of scientific texts, of diagrams, of maps. They tell you what types of things the texts, the maps, the diagrams are representing. And types here are also called kinds or universals or categories. These are types, taxons, and these are the instances down here. This is John. And then there are continuants and occurrence. So you are a continuant. A continuant is an entity which continues to exist. And an occurrent is an entity which occurs, like your life or this arm waving. You are three-dimensional, an occurrent is four-dimensional. Your life has a temporal axis. You do not have a temporal axis. You have three spatial axes. You can come up here, Neil. Now, the third one is between dependent and independent. So, dependent entities are such that they require independent entities as their bearers. So, grins require cats, runs require runners, pumpings require pumps, kisses require kissers and kissies, and so forth. The things on the left are dependent continuants, the things on the right are independent continuants. Diseases are dependent continuance. And Neil will fill in some of the background for this in the next section, and you can mess with this if you wish.
I'm in the position of being slightly uncomfortably wedged in the middle of Barry's talk, which is a strange place to be, though I believe some of the stuff I'm doing will actually prove informative in the end of some of the stuff he's doing. the stuff I'm working with is largely conceptual, and I'd come here today thinking that this was well accepted and well believed, that in order to have a disease ontology you needed a concept of disease. Now I still believe it, but I realize that not many other people seem to believe it.
You have to understand that the word the word concept has been used in related communities in somewhat confused and sloppy ways.
So we need a concept of concept.
So my policy has been that anyone who uses the word should give me a dollar. So just be careful.
I'm still of the mind that if you actually want a disease ontology which countenances all and only those things that are diseases, then you need a definition of disease by which to legislate those things which should be included inside the ontology and those which should not.
The only problem is we just can't agree on that definition.
I understand. So I mean, no, but I mean, there seemed to be more than just a lack of agreement. There seemed to be a lack of agreement and a strong swelling of, and we don't even need one. That I don't dispute with. So naturally, if we're going to get one, if we are going to achieve one, it's going to have to be highly interoperable, as Barry's been saying. And it's going to be closely connected with health, normality, and adaptive success. That doesn't come up very well. Anyway, part of what's changing in the sort of way of thinking about disease and problems with the kind of definitions we have out there, which I think most of the lack of satisfaction comes precisely from the fact that the definitions we have on offer at present simply don't cut it. And part of that difficulty comes with an aim towards reduction, as if everything could be broken down at every level, which is clearly failing. When you've got things that go on at an organ level and things that go on a cellular level, things that go on a molecular level, it's not simply the case that everything can be crammed into the molecular level. It simply doesn't follow. But we still want something unified. And heading in that direction, part of what's coming about and part of what I'm trying to make use of, and some of the work I'm doing with Lou, who will be speaking tomorrow, concerns a move towards thinking about these things in terms of interactive networks and in terms of the dispositional natures of cells, how they actually work and how they work when they're being healthy. So basically what I'm going to be talking about today for the next 20 minutes or so is just a basic introduction to the notion of dispositionality and some of its sort of similar cognates and how these can help inform a viable concept of disease. What I take to be a viable concept, anyway. So described to an object as a disposition is to indicate that it possesses a certain potentiality. It is capable of doing something. It's to say something about how an object will be, hereby the manifestation, if certain conditions, the stimulus, are to obtain. It says little, primarily, about what it is present. It says something about the way it will be given certain stimulus. So, in the case of fragility, standard dispositional description, to say of a glass that it's fragile is not to say that it's now broken. It's to say that it will be if you shiver it, drop it, so on and so forth. It will say something about its present state, but the tendency within the dispositional description is to be saying something about a future state given certain conditions. The standard contrast with the dispositional is against those properties which are known as categorical properties, those that describe how an object presently is. They're sometimes, in a sort of very Aquinas-esque type way, described as being in pure act. They are currently recognizing everything that's there. The difference between the two is typically understood in terms of subjunctive conditionals. Dispositional properties suggest or entail subjunctive conditionals, whereas categorical properties do not. A subjunctive conditional is a form of if-then statement. So we are saying of dispositional descriptions and dispositional properties that they are closely connected with ascribing to them a conditional of this sort. That if you do such and such, then you will have such and such as a result. Whereas your categorical properties, such things as squareness or putatively redness, or so on and so forth, don't seem to have this quite so close tie with anything subjunctive. They seem to say something about how the object is at any given time, and it seems to be fully captured in that. To say that something is square is not to say, though it may be more loosely connected with, but it's not to say primarily how it will be if some certain circumstances are to obtain. There's our sort of subjunctive conditional in the case of fragility. That if the glass were to be dropped, then it was shattered. Three important features of dispositions. The first is an independence. And this is the part where I think up until this point, people's familiarity with the notion of dispositionality is fairly standard. It's when you get the line of independence that people start to raise eyebrows. The having of a disposition and the possessing of a disposition by some object is such that it maintains that disposition even if those conditions for its manifestation never obtain. Simply put, the glass is fragile even if it never manifests its fragility. This is going to become sort of important in the cellular cases in that we've got dispositions of cells which they have despite the fact that their circumstances may be such that their location in the body or the kinds of things they're interacting with are such that they will never manifest certain dispositions that they have. There's a certain danger overlooking them. The second feature that's sort of important in terms of dispositions and then going to be their place in disease especially is that they operate reciprocally. No disposition works on its own. Dispositions work mutually in concert with other dispositions of other objects. So in the case of something like salt solubility, if salt is to manifest its solubility, it can't do so unless it does in concert with the solvency of the solution. If the solution isn't appropriately disposed, then the dispositions of the salt lack the reciprocal match, you don't get the appropriate manifestation. This becomes important when you start to see cells working in networks in terms of their partnerships. Just because a cell possesses a certain disposition doesn't mean it'll get to be manifest unless those cells it's partnered with also have the reciprocal disposition. And finally, these things are intrinsic to them. Though manifestations are something that might get shared across objects because they work together, the dispositions themselves are intrinsic to their possessors. They move with their possessors regardless of location, regardless of the likelihood of manifestation. All right. Though connected, slightly different line. It's important that when we speak about dispositions of objects, we worry about the question of whether or not we have true or false descriptions. In that mind, we have two important facts. It's that dispositions can be lost or gained without ever having been manifested. Though a sort of an example of a philosophical nature, we can certainly imagine cases in which some sort of piece of glassware which was once fragile now fails to be. Or that some piece of glass which was not previously fragile becomes fragile. Dare I say, things can change. If we can understand change of objects, it seems reasonable we could talk about change of dispositions, particularly given that they can go unmanifested. When we have certain safety protocols set up to counteract certain conditions, we can imagine cases in which those safety conditions are no longer needed because the object in question or the objects in question have actually changed. Secondly, two objects cannot be perfect duplicates, yet differ in terms of their dispositions. This just seems like the kind of point we should accept generally. But if these two points are going to be true, if these two facts are actually going to hold when it comes to speaking of any kind of object, then we need some feature by which we can attest to the fact that these dispositions are carried with them. To that end, we need some kind of ground or basis for our disposition descriptions.
Yeah, I have a question related to the previous slide. It goes to this one a little bit. Go to the previous one. For the independence there, does the disposition cease to exist when it becomes manifested?
It needn't cease to exist. But at the point of its manifestation, it then gives rise to some future state of the object. It might then be the case that it's exhausted. It might then be the case that its very manifestation is perhaps of a later version of itself. Or so it may be that a cell with a certain disposition gets manifested. The manifestation is the cell having certain dispositions, namely ones identical to those prior to it, or something to that effect.
They are identical, you don't mean numerically identical.
I can do it. Depends what you want to think about properties. But I think there's a reasonable sense in which you can just think that the manifestation is that it will continue to be there and continue to be a disposition which itself can move on.
I was going to wait. This has been better.
Quite right.
So two questions. One about the independence. Independence from conditions. So.
There's a tendency here to think about these things as being context-linked.
Well, I'm trying to think about it again. I'm trying to think, and maybe that's my mistake. I'm trying to think about disease. So if you want to equate in some way disease with disposition.
I don't, but maybe that's the problem.
If you don't, then
I just actually think that this is the model that's going to help us then start to situate how we think about disease when we get there. By treating the actual objects involved in these kind of processes and thinking about them the right way, we're going to be able to insert disease in the right kind of place.
So are you going to get to describing how dispositions might help us think about disease?
Yes.
Okay.
Though the answer may not be entirely satisfying.
It seems to be a lot of that.
Part of this had to change fairly quickly, so yeah, let's get that. All right, I think we came to this. So we need a ground. Standard responses to how to find a ground is to say that there is some categorical property that serves its base. This is far and away the most sort of popular treatment of thinking about dispositions. To say that the disposition of fragility is something that glasses have, it's had in virtue of something like molecular structure. But there are a few less popular accounts that treat certain dispositions in terms of more basic dispositional properties. So you might agree that a glass is fragile, but think that something like molecular structure is itself dispositional. It's just perhaps more basic. It grounds a series of them. But the standard, and under what goes with the name most of the time, is functionalism. Dispositional functionalism is a theory in which you have categorical bases, and these are the reasons why you have differing dispositions. Other terms in the dispositional family, which get used a lot, and so it's worth sort of thinking about these things and clarifying, at least in terms of how they get used within the dispositional literature, which is probably the best place to go. A propensity is typically used to denote a probabilistic disposition. So to say that something has a certain propensity means that it may manifest something. It has a disposition, but it has a disposition that doesn't reliably produce its manifestation upon stimulus. So things like particle decay is a largely propensity. It's something that isn't done reliably. It's not something that's done in those kind of conditions when we expect it to obtain. What's next? Tendency, another connected notion. A tendency is typically used to denote a habitual disposition. Dispositions are such that they can go unmanifested. It might be, though it tends not to have been the case, that historically no glass had ever broken. That wouldn't do anything to take away the presence of the disposition if glasses are in fact fragile. When it comes to a tendency, we have something regular and reliable. If you think about something like, contrast the ability to smoke, a disposition which we probably all possess, I would tend to think, versus the tendency, which is something that gets manifest repeatedly, reliably, and from which we can predict future manifestations. Being able to smoke and being a smoker are not nearly the same thing. And finally, the notion of causal power. In some instances, causal power is used synonymously with disposition. The two just go back and forth. Certainly, the further you go back in the literature, the meaning of the two is synonymous. More recently, it's come to replace these notions of basic dispositional properties. So for those people who aren't so friendly with the idea that we have to have changes in categorical properties to have changes in dispositions, power is the name given to these more basic general abilities of objects. All right. Why think in terms of dispositions, especially when we're thinking about disease? Laws, which are a standard sort of model for tracking these kind of causal scenarios, track regularities in situ. They stick to a single instance. And they ignore the irregular. They're used to hammering out the irregular in order to get the norms, which misses precisely the kind of class of cases we're most interested in. Cells, furthermore, are capable of far more than the kinds of things we ever see mapped or the kinds of things we ever get well-tracked within any kind of law-like model. Cells are going to have dispositions that, because of where they're presently located, don't get manifested. However, relocate those cells, have something occur so that the situations are slightly different than what had previously been there, cells start doing things unexpected. And it's precisely these unexpected things that we're most interested in. And finally, we have billions of clone cells engaged in unique activity. Dispositions give place to these varied abilities. Certain cells and certain groups of cells are such that they can be moved around the body and pushed into tasks that they're not previously exercising. This isn't something that fits well when we're thinking about laws. It fits well when you begin to think of cells as little centers, as centers of potentiality, dispositional hubs. So whereas a dispositional hub will only have a few of those spokes realized, recognizing the presence of those other spokes gives you a greater understanding of what it can do and then what it does when finally you put it somewhere else. The laws themselves only actually track those spokes that ever get realized, so it's a very limited set. Just because there are paths we don't go down doesn't mean those paths aren't there. They overlook the wider range of abilities and limit cellular roles. I've talked elsewhere, and part of the sort of driving force behind the way I like to think about these things is a form of opposition to the kind of functionalism, which is very common in disease terminologies and disease theories. Functionality and function is another way that begins to sort of limit cellular capabilities. Rather than seeing your sort of cell as a potentiality center, you focus on one or two of those things that happen to get done frequently, given the particular conditions it's in. And then again, you're not prepared for it to be elsewhere. You're not prepared for the conditions to change around it and for the kind of manifestations it'll then give rise to. And dare I say, I think one of the sort of strongest reasons here is that in a want to think about disease in terms of networks of cells, it's the reciprocal nature of dispositions which is most apt for that kind of modeling. So I have, in a short space, a minor proposal that I've been working with in terms of definition of disease, which I just want to focus on where the dispositional comes into this thing and how it gets used. So I will have the audacity to present a definition of disease here. You can feel free to abuse it to whatever extent. At present, I take disease to be a prolonged distortion of cellular network processes, wherein the activities of the networks, one, fall outside an acceptable normal range for the organism's species, two, are not capable of remedy by the system itself without thereby distorting the activities of some other network, and three, tend to reduce the organism's ability to cope with environmental pressures. What I want to focus on, and I'll return to that if we want afterwards, is this notion of distortion, as this is where I think the definition is probably most important, as it brings in the feature of what it is to be normal, and it's against normality and working that way that the cellular dispositional model starts to do the most work. So let me just jump through there. So what's a distortion? Simply put, it's a deviation from a standard process. This is where our notions of norms come in. It's probably the hardest problem in any kind of case in establishing a definition for disease. So we need to determine, in some sense, what counts as the norm or standards for the kind of processes that could then count as distorted. Effectively, what we're talking about is health. And it's with regards to health and distortions, but thinking in terms of dispositions and the networks they form and mutually interact in, provide the biggest gap. So a healthy process is a matter of various dispositions, some acting to bring about needed changes and responses, and others working to maintain the status quo. The body, I'm sure it's not news to you, is a very busy place, even when very little seems to be going on. Even when health is maintained, there is a sort of buzz of activity that goes on all the time. We don't get health for free. If you fail to put yourself in unhealthy circumstances, it doesn't mean you just simply get health out of it. And recognizing the amount of work that goes into that maintaining those standard instances of health is important in understanding what's going to come about for disease. So we get various processes as judged over time that are both dynamic and static. We have smaller changes that account for a general sort of maintenance of the status quo. Norms then can be established by looking at what they do in terms of what they can do and what they in fact do. And, though I mentioned it wishfully, locating some statistical standards, because it's that easily done, of course. And it's against this statistical backdrop of dispositional norms that we start to consider our notion of distortion. Dare I say, I think it's one of the problematic areas of thinking about disease is that what seems to be concerned most in the cases of disease are diseased individuals, diseased organs, diseased cases. What probably matters most to our understanding of disease is the standard case, the standard individual, the non-diseased individual. The more we can learn about that individual, the more we can assist, help, understand the disease case. So with this sort of dispositional notion, and thinking about network processes as individual cells interacting in certain ways, we can start to see places for distortion, which is where I think dispositions are helping the most. We have a number, vast numbers in fact, of causally interacting cells. And these processes can start to go awry. They can go awry because you change the environment in which the cell is situated. Or you change the entire network and relocate it. Or you relocate the entire organism such that its external environment changes. Any of these kind of changes can change the operation of the cell. Change the operation of the cell, and we run into trouble. Yes?
Maybe this went by me over my head, but it seems like if you could have a distortion, if you will. Let's say somebody is going through mourning, okay, and they get seriously depressed. But maybe that's a normal response to that change in the environment. So, I mean, is that sort of threatened that might be a...
In
response, or even in the changed environment, you put the lactose into the media, and
unfortunately,
you get a change.
My time allotment was limited, so I had to sort of rush through the definition. But it does include there. I mean, I think the two features that respond to what you're worried about are that it be prolonged, and that it not be the kind of thing that the organism can respond to naturally and come back. Natural processes and part of what it is to be healthy is to have a constant flux of sort of in and out in terms of what's going on and how well you're dealing with it. But there's generally a return to sort of standard health within that model. So, I mean, health is a homeostatic system. And so unless those cases are such that they're prolonged and can't be dealt with naturally by the system, then I think you might have grounds for disease. I think perhaps ridiculously, extended mourning might itself be some form of disease.
Does this mean that self-limited illnesses are not diseases?
Then it depends about the ability to whether there's a reduction in terms of adaptive success. If you have something that the body can maintain, it doesn't take you outside the norms particularly, and it doesn't reduce your success, then I would conjecture this falls outside the space of the kind of things we need for disease.
So like in an acute case of food poisoning, I'm miserable for 24 hours, completely disabled by it. That's not an illness, that's not a disease, that doesn't...
I didn't say it wasn't an illness. I would have said it wasn't a disease. I wouldn't say that all cases of things that need medical remedy, shall we say, are themselves diseases. I don't, for instance, sort of harkening back to discussions this morning, think that a cut on one's arm is a disease. I think it's something that needs remedy. I think it's a sort of a distortion of your basic physical structure. but it's not a disease. I mean, dare I say, there's going to be, at any point, an attempt to establish a disease sort of definition. There will be cases that are going to have to fall on the boundaries, and some will fall outside and some will fall inside. One just has to hope that we get the majority of best cases and a decent amount of agreement, and then the rest is spoils to the victor.
Yeah, I still don't capture whether this is distortion, actually. It's not. Let's think in terms of the three basic dichotomies that Barry just raised. Is it a continuum or is it a process? Is it dependent or is it independent? From start.
I haven't answered that question.
Are you going to?
Not today.
So
I actually don't think, in terms of thinking about disease, whether I want to track it that way, I yet need to answer the problem. That might be a problem I can sort of leave to someone else if the definition is something that they're satisfied with otherwise.
Yeah, but I
tend not to think of it as a continuum, but I think you actually could if you wanted to, if you insisted. Because it may have stages. So it may actually exhibit both continuum and process-like states.
Okay, my next question would then be, what would then be the relation with the normal process?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
So, sure.
You explain distortion in terms of a standard. Standards are human artifacts. Weren't there diseases before we standardized people?
I don't think standards are human artifacts. Mathematical representations of them are, but it's not those that your disease is being judged against. It is what happens to be normal across individuals. We might never know that. It doesn't take away the disease.
The choices which are made to build in a canonical anatomy, for example, that would be something, one of the standards you've probably heard of, is some of the choices are definitely arbitrary. I don't know how many lobes of the lung are there in the human anatomy, but I'm sure there are. But you know, can't have more or less in a range without being diseased. So I don't understand the standard which is not human, not a human artifact.
I only think the preferential instances of standards would have to become a hard artifact. There will be cases where the stats fall to in the middle, and then you have to make a choice, and that will be our doing. But that may mean that some instances of what kind of diseases.
Okay, so
but
like,
I don't think it's a general problem. I think standards
so
exist.
So you don't mean standard. You mean something like statistical average or something like that.
I'd say that to be standard.
Okay.
But that's what you said. A distortion is judged against a backdrop of statistical norms.
Yes. So it's judged against. That doesn't make its existence reliant on our having actually done any or made any decisions about statistics. I mean, the statistical standards exist prior to our ever having collected them.
Normal
is
normal without having measured it.
So statistical, if it's statistically normal, or on average people with older than 90 have Alzheimer's, and Alzheimer's is not a disease. For people who are older than that.
And that's where the space of what constitutes the species and how wide it is. This is, I mean, it's certainly an issue that the definition is struggling with, which is what counts as normal and what age range. I think it's probably reasonable to think that what counts as normal is not what goes on in a 90-year-old.
It is for a 90-year-old.
So, I mean, there are going to be many dimensions of norm. There's norm across the species. There's norm across the species at a time. I mean, you can imagine.
Norm across the environment the species finds itself in.
Change the environment. Imagine some sort of massive worldwide Holocaust type situation where we have some fallout. It's huge.
You don't need to do that. All you need to do is imagine a change in the abundance of food.
Fair enough.
I mean, and so that's where. So using that as an example, walk me through why it is that if you have a shortage of food and a particular genetic makeup, such as our species may have in general, and it's an advantage to have that metabolic system and have that same individual in the presence of an abundant food supply and have a deficit, have a disease result as a consequence of that, or have a condition which affects your ability to reproduce, your ability to thrive, is that a disease or is it not?
Is evolution a disease?
And see, that's I mean, this issue of, you know, sort of independence, I think...
It's not entire independence. I mean, there's going to be sort of spectra of adaptive success and then spectra of norms across groups, larger groups, and time. And so there's going to have to be a determination at some stage as to whether we care about that. If all of us happen to be some way and it's recognized that this differs from the way we all were some time ago.
It's not that we differ.
Well, we may differ.
It's just that our environment.
It could be the environment, it could be us. I mean, both kind of changes take place. It's going to then have to be sort of temporally relative. We wouldn't go about attempting to remedy everything.
Or spatially relative.
Or spatially dependent, yes. Though ideally you'd like to remove away from that. But if people happen to live in, you know, the tropics and things operate slightly differently, then naturally what counts as sort of the standards for health there will differ. But that doesn't seem disagreeable.
Why don't you finish this page?
All right, let me finish this page. This is the last page, do we? Resources, as we're saying, lack or surplus. Absences. When your cells are such that they operate in concert with other cells to produce certain states, it may be enough for a sort of a distortion within a process that certain other partners go missing, or certain chemicals go missing. So they fail to operate in the kind of ways that they want to or ought to. There are the standard germ cases where we insert some other kind of foreign body that interacts with it, and so now the processes run outside of the norms. And then there are sort of internal instructional problems having to do with like transcription and its own sort of coding. And likewise, communications which are connected in the same kind of way between interacting cells and groups of interacting cells. And I think that's
stop. So, a couple more questions.
So how does this help us understand the concept of disease then?
Well, it's part of what helps you understand it. It sets up a model in thinking the right kind of way. If you look at accounts of what it is to be a disease at present, they are almost all state that there is some kind of function, and that if there is some sort of deviation from that function, then you have a disease. And things are certainly more complex than that. They needn't be restricted to function. It's one good indicator of disease, but you shouldn't be limited to those kind of cases. It's much sort of wider. Things can operate and perform their function and yet be completely diseased or be parasitic on other systems. So you look for the wrong place for disease. System A is functioning perfectly fine in terms of its inputs and outputs, but it's using too much, or it's doing too much, or it's using too much energy, and system B is therefore being sort of attacked. You might look for the source of disease in B, because the functional model pushes you in the wrong case. So it's an attempt to start to find something that's going to avoid those kind of problems, for starters.
So I'm trying to understand how this applies where we don't have models that tell us about the cellular level of diseases. Do we just punt and say, well, we assume there's some cellular interaction going on, but we really don't understand it? And still allow them to be diseases, or do we have to set a bunch of things aside and say we don't know whether these are diseases or not?
Third gets back to the question this morning of, is something only disease when we understand its etiology?
Bipolar and schizophrenia, are those diseases or not? I mean, by most criteria, those are mental diseases. We don't have... I mean, maybe psychiatrists know more than I do about the cellular interaction, but I don't think we really understand very much at all about what's going on at a cellular level. And
I think the response there is that we work away from the standard cases. Definitionally, they would fall within a wider sense of disease if the kind of networks are even individuals or their brains or groups of individuals. And they may not fall right back down to cellular processes, but then again, they might too. So I don't think there's any quick response.
Well, in those cases, there's almost certainly a cellular, we just don't know it yet. There's almost certainly a cellular basis.
Right, we assume there is, but I mean the definition can't be applied, really. At least, as I understand it, I can't apply that definition. These are cases where I say, well, my definition is here and my thing is here, and they don't match up. I can't apply it. I don't know whether it really meets those criteria or not.
which would leave you not knowing whether you could apply the criteria or not. But that's an epistemic worry. It's not a worry about, I mean, the point being that if you eventually discover that there are certain cellular issues, then you are sort of vindicated if you believed it was a disease.
And right, but any definition that leaves a very large number of current diseases outside of the, epistemically, regardless, I mean, if it's outside of the application of the definition, then it's really not that helpful.
Well, how much is this just sort of our human-centric point of view? I mean, we went through this with the GO a whole lot, whereas, you know, from the microbe's point of view, infecting a host, I mean, pathogen is a very pejorative term. It's very much from it's from the viewpoint of the individual, whether it's a plant or a human or whatever, being attacked. You know, but from the microbe's point of view, this is just, you know, getting by.
Yeah.
It's perfectly normal. It's what it was built for. No, but I mean, but I'm just thinking that this whole thing about, you know, how much of this is just the fact that we have a sort of a viewpoint on things, this normal, abnormal. I mean, all we want to do is describe a situation. We can put whatever labels we want on it. We can call it diseases because those are from our perspective, it's bad. But these good-bad judgments, I just don't know if this is...
I actually move away. It's independent, but I actually have a sort of want to move away from the idea that sort of disease bad. It's just disease, extendedly abnormal, and then
abnormal is the same problem.
I don't think it has to be, because somebody who is super healthy and super adapted is themselves abnormal in an interesting manner, and we might consider that a disease.
Yeah.
And then track what they do because they fall outside standard ranges.
So centenarians are diseased by that definition.
You needn't always, disease doesn't always have to be partnered with a remedy.
So one last question, Stefan.
It's more a comment than a question. My point of view, after all these discussions and tentative of definitions of disease, my conclusion is it makes no sense at all to define what a disease is. And I would say, of course, everybody has his or her own concept of disease or normal or abnormal, but I think there will be never any consensus, and so I think it is better to not to talk about diseases in this workshop, but to talk about some more global thing, such as conditions or situations or phenotypical things or something like that. I think this would be much more fruitful than really to introduce this notion of disease, where it's always this dichotomy between bad or good or normal, abnormal, and so on. I think another thing which shed light on the problematic issue with disease is that in different languages we have quite different names. For instance, in English there's illness, disease, sickness. It's not exactly the same. In my language it's only one term. In French I think it's only one term. And so everybody has a different view on this phenomenon.
That's why we're here.
But look at the trade-off. I mean, the trade-off is that if you want to collect these things so you've got systematic information, you need a beginning. Yeah, we do have disease and illness and all these different words. And if we don't actually get them organized, then think about what the product's going to look like. Or we just drop the whole idea and just have them in general, like anything bad that looks like a symptom.
I think talking about conditions and conditions or functions, situations which are observed in living subjects, I think this is just as exciting as talking about diseases. And I think if we start with this and leave out of account this distinction, this dichotomy between normal and abnormal, I think we will be more productive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and describe them, but the real things, not the subjective things.
They're not subjective, as we shall see. Yeah. But anyway, let's have some coffee now.
But Mary, in the sense that you were talking about earlier of
starting with the focal points. This is about the boundary setting.
Exactly. We're arguing about boundaries once again. You should be arguing about pneumonia.
But this is argues in favor of the whole condition approach as opposed to the disease.
Even the condition is going to have a boundary.
It's the same issue. It's just a different name for the same thing.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, at the end of the day...
It points a condition to be healthy at 90 years of age. It's a condition. And it's not a disease.
Yeah.
Alright, coffee time, ladies and gentlemen.
We have tried for years and failed. So maybe it's like colors and you'll eventually succeed.
We should never give up.
Don't give up.
Yeah.
Oh,
right. Can I borrow your power slot?
Yes.
We can swap around if you like.
Is
your talk on your
own?
Very interesting, isn't it?
We
have a long way to go.
Today? Now?
All right, it's not a tie.
I don't know, I got off on
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I should say that. I have to do something.
I don't know. I did think one of the places to get things here to the
I'm going to go to the next one. Thank you.
Does that all hold all in memory?
This, it says it holds 68 hours.
Wow.
We'll see. I'm not been deleting stuff yet, but I probably will delete
this
stuff at the end of the day.
Is it a WAV file or?
Yes.
MP3
yeah.
WAV.
Yeah. And it's very, very elegant the way it plugs into the machine.
Yeah. And then you can just download it to your
computer. Yeah. It recognizes it like a USB stick.
Very cool.
So this is the very simple top-level ontology, and the dispositions which Neil were talking about are dependent continuance. That is to say, you never have a disposition without it being the disposition of or in some bearer. And a manifestation of the disposition, for instance, the breaking of the glass as a process which takes place in a certain interval of time, is an occurrence. Occurrence, too, always have their bearers or carriers. And this is exactly the ontology underlying the gene ontology. So biological processes occurrence, molecular functions are dependent continuance, and cell components are independent continuance. And anatomy is just this particular domain of reality, which includes
anatomical structures like bones and portions of body substance like portions of blood or urine. Now, the Ghost 3 ontologies are organized like this, and there are, in fact, functions not just at the molecular level, but also at other levels. And Neil is right that we should not focus on disease exclusively in terms of function, but since functions are a very important family of dispositions, then we at least ought to address those functions which are connected with diseases. And a simple one would be the function of the heart. The function of the heart is to pump blood. Your heart has this function. Each of you has a heart function. The heart may have many other functions, but at least it has this function. But not every activity in your body is the exercise of any function. So there are malfunctionings, for instance. When your heart stops pumping, it will still be undergoing processes, but they will not be pumping processes. They will not be realizations or executions of the function of your heart. And then there are side effects, like your heart's beating. The function of your heart is not to beat. And there will be accidents of various kinds. So there are what we might think of as elite processes within the organism, which are functionings. And then there are various kinds of junk processes, which are not functionings. Now, the FMA calls itself a canonical representation. What that means is that it's representing, as it says, the types and relations between types which anatomists over many years have deduced from their observations of human bodies. They've deduced a certain representation as being the representation of the normal human body. The FMA is an attempt to encapsulate this representation. The GO2 is a canonical representation, although it's not quite systematically consistent in following this rule. It describes itself as being a computational representation of the ways in which gene products normally function in the biological realm. So we have both normal here and function here. This means wild-type mice who have not been injected with steroids and poked with various measuring devices. It means functions which are uninterfered with. So we have functions, and we have functionings, and then we have various other kinds of processes. And we have normal functions, and then we have various kinds of abnormalities. And we're getting now towards diseases. So first of all, as I hope is clear by now, diseases are not events or processes or occurrence. A myocardial infarction is not a disease, because it's an event.
Depends on what you mean.
Depends on what you mean, yes. But if you mean a myocardial infarction as an event, then it's not a disease. And this is because a disease is something realizable, like a function. So a function gets realized through executions, through functionings. Diseases get realized through disease processes. So a disease has a course or history. This is proved by the fact that there are symptom-suppressant drugs. And these symptom-suppressant drugs may ideally eliminate all symptoms and signs of the disease, but the disease still exists, it still goes on behind the scenes. So a disease can never be identical with any specific sequence or pattern of symptoms. Rather, it's something which is identically running on, enduring, which is giving rise to certain manifestations. It's becoming realized. And the collection of the realizations of the disease through time is the course or history of a disease. So this is a misprint. This should say diseases are continuance.
Over what time frame, Barry?
I'm coming to that. And that's probably a boundary question.
Because I'm thinking of ventricular fibrillation.
Yes.
You know, some electrical stimulus. It's a process. It's a function. It might happen in a
nanosecond. Yep.
But it's still a process.
It's not a disease, though, for several reasons.
Well,
off the top of my head.
I'll wait till you come to it.
Good. So, diseases are dependent continuance. Causes or histories of disease, like malfunctionings, are occurrence. diseases are not symptoms then. Psoriasis as a disease and psoriasis as a manifestation, a skin rash, are two different things. So Kent is nodding his head. And cancer as a disease is a different thing from cancer as a tumor. And I hope that that is by now obvious. And the disease is distinct from the bearer of the disease. So a mushy brain is not a disease. It's a brain. And a broken leg is not a disease, it's a leg. So again, all of this should be obvious. It never does any harm to belabor the obvious.
The difficulty is that people use the same words
yep.
to mean both the disease
yep.
and the bearer of the disease or the event of the thing happening.
Yeah, so some people use the word breast to mean the third breast cancer patient in the fourth bed on the left. And they are probably not following good terminological habits.
But we're not the police. We can't.
You may not be the police. So.
Ask him, he'll show you his badge.
Just so, a question.
Yeah.
The broken leg, of course, the broken leg is not a disease, it is a leg, a modified anatomical structure. But a leg fracture, what is it?
It's not a disease.
It's an injury.
It's a condition.
I think there are several things. There is the very moment in which the bone fractures.
That's and just an event.
An event. And yeah. then the most important, perhaps, is the state of a patient
yeah.
with a broken yeah. leg.
So I think that every case of broken leg is almost certainly going to give rise to a disease. But the disease is not the fracture of the leg. The fracture of a leg is a certain topological, geometrical...
What about a pathological fracture?
That sounds as if it, again, it's not quite following good terminological...
What about a
gangrenous leg is a leg. That's an easy one. His pathological fracture is more difficult. Let me just... So you agree that a fracture is a certain kind of topological, geometrical aspect of bone material?
I haven't quite signed on that a broken leg isn't a disease, but that's okay. I'm challenging your notion. You're saying it's not a disease because presumably it's an external cause of injury that is causing a mechanical malformation not attributable to the human organism.
Yeah. But there is a malformation. The malformation will almost certainly give rise to a disease.
But if you have an osteosarcoma.
And I don't know what that is.
Oh, it's a bone cancer.
Okay, that sounds to me as if.
And the leg breaks.
Yeah.
Because which is, yeah. in that instance would be a pathological.
Okay,
fracture.
So the cancer, in virtue of which we have the manifestation, which is the sarcoma, is a disease. The fracture is a part. The fracture event is a part of the history of that disease.
It might even be a sign or symptom of the disease, but it's not the disease.
So, there are types, including the disease type, and then various subtypes of the disease type, for instance, pneumonia. And then there are instances. So, Mary's pneumonia is an instance of the type disease, and Mary's coughing is an instance of one occurrent type, which is the coughing type. Which is also related to the disease. This
so
particular
Mary's pneumonia is a continuum.
Mary's pneumonia is a continuum. It starts to exist at a certain time, goes on existing identically for a long period of time, and then stops existing, if you're lucky. That sounds to me like a continuum. The very same pneumonia gives rise to a sequence of symptoms and signs.
How is that different from any other self-limiting process that Mary may go on?
I'm coming to that. So it's not a process at all. A disease is not a process.
That's what you're saying.
The course of a disease.
Which I don't believe at all.
The course of a disease is a process. And the argument, again, has to do with symptom suppressant drugs. So if let's suppose that you have Mary. In one world, Mary is affected by some sort of pathogen in virtue of which she gets pneumonia. In another world, she's affected in exactly the same way, by exactly the same pathogen, in which she gets pneumonia. So we have two identical worlds. In the first world, Mary does not take any drugs. In the second world, she takes the anti-pneumonia symptom drug and shows no symptoms at all, but she still has the disease.
And that means that the course of the disease in the two worlds is completely different. But it's the same disease. And therefore the disease is not identical with its course. So, yes?
If I accept it from the point that all of us have a disease of not producing vitamin C, therefore we have
to... I'll come to that. I'll come to that. That's a boundary question which I will address later. So, I'll get to it. And if I don't, then you just press me again.
So,
yeah.
So tell me exactly, how do I tell the difference between those continuant dependent continuants that are abnormal, which are something like a fracture, which you say are not a disease, versus things like pneumonia, which are a disease.
I'm coming to that distinction. But a fracture is a topological geometrical affect of a bone matter. And the pneumonia is something quite different. Pneumonia is realizable in certain characteristic ways, which you can then cure in certain characteristic ways. A fracture is not realizable. It sits there. It doesn't need to be realized. It's like a shape. It's topological.
That's not transdynamic process.
Yeah.
No, there is a process of fracturing, and then there is another process of healing. But the fracture itself, and I choose another word if you like, is like a shape. It doesn't need to be realized. It's not a process, nor is it anything which is realized in a process. It just sits there. It's like the shape of this table. If I break this table, then we will have a fracture.
It's an independent continuum?
No, it's a dependent continuum, because the shape always is the shape of some independent bearer.
Okay, so it would be equivalent to a function or something else as a child.
There is the quality over here. A quality includes shape qualities, color qualities, and so on. They are dependent continuums which have bearers, which are the colored, shaped things. But these are inert, where functions and diseases are both erred. They get realized. And diseases also heard. Yes?
I'm just wondering what would prevent me, though, from making a sort of analogy between Mary's respiratory system or something and her leg, right? Why can't I say that... case of pneumonia is simply a topological thing. It's a respiratory
good, yeah.
system.
That's a very good question. That's a very good question.
It's a consolidation.
You will see why it's a good question later on.
So you're saying that her consolidation is the same as the fracture, but her pneumonia is...
So the process, a fracture will typically give rise to certain harmful processes in the body. And it's also to certain good processes.
Not consolidation process. I mean, the consolidated lung has a relationship to pneumonia.
Yes.
The way the fractured leg has to some disease, which
we
also call fracture.
Exactly. And we shouldn't. You agree? You shouldn't use the same words to mean all these different things.
We shouldn't. That's
the processes give rise to processes.
Yes, of course.
So to agree that the course of a disease is a process and not the disease is not to agree that the disease is not a process. So with your healthy Mary and your Mary with the disease...
No, it's not healthy Mary and Mary with the disease. It's Mary with symptoms.
Mary with symptoms.
Yeah. Yeah.
We admit that the process of the course of the disease, which is being countered, is a process and is not the disease. It says nothing about whether the disease itself is
if you accept diseases with processes, then you have to explain how two processes which are, from the point of view of manifestations, can be completely different. Can be, and therefore from the point of view of processes, can be completely different, can yet be instances of the same type. And one very good way of doing that is to identify the disease as an underlying continuum, like a quality or like a disposition.
So as a consequence, this means that the disease has no parts. Or no time-dependent parts.
No, it doesn't.
Otherwise it would be an occurrence.
The course of the disease comes in stages, yes.
Yeah,
but the disease itself does not have any temporal parts, just as you do not have any temporal parts.
Your life has, but you don't.
All right, so the functions versus functionings, the function of your heart is to pump blood. This function is realized in process of pumping blood.
Now, Neil was referring to various function-related theories of disease, so there is the abnormality theory, which says that a disease is a state of a person which issues in abnormal behavior, and then something is an abnormal or bodily mental process, so abnormal behavior, if it does standard members of the human species some harm in standard circumstances. And something does a person harm if it makes the person less able to lead a good or worthwhile life. I believe in some parts of the first parts of this. I think this is somewhat along the right lines, but we...
Jet lag fits.
Jet lag, yes, of course. Jet lag. So we are, but we have to get rid of jet lag, of course. So what are standard circumstances? That's a boundary question which we need to address, but it's not important. It shouldn't keep us from the main track. But the more interesting question is, what are states and how do they issue in consequences? So a disease is a state which issues in certain consequences. That is the important question. How can a disease issue in consequences? Now, the talk about dispositions from Neil was intended to help us along in this respect. Diseases are dispositions. They are powerful qualities, powerful dependent continuance which get hold of you and make things happen. Like learning Greek, which is a powerful thing which gets hold of you and makes things happen. It's just that learning Greek is not one of the bad guys, it's one of the good guys. So your knowledge of Greek is a dependent continuum which endures through time. And your pneumonia is a dependent continuum which endures through time. Now, this view is shared also by Larissa et al., who attempt to produce a definition of disease which will still work in the future, which is what I'm trying to do and it's what Rex is trying to do. So we want to move away from traditional conceptions of disease, which are, in our view, overly focused on signs and symptoms, and try and find an understanding of disease which will still work in the future. But they use the same terminology. A disease is a state that places individuals at increased risk of adverse consequences. And then we need to know, how do states do this? We need to know what states are. Larissa et al. Point out that there are some genetic variations which have no adverse consequences, and they are not diseases. So this is obvious, but if we're going to attempt to link diseases with the future of genomic medicine, then we need to recognize that not all genetic variations are going to be such that they're associated with diseases, and then the question arises, which ones are? Chris?
I don't disagree with the notion, Barry, and it's a plausible notion that should be pursued. However, I submit you're doing to the word disease sort of, kind of, what you did to the word concept. You're taking a word that has a broad understanding in the lay community, and indeed, I should add, the health professionals community, and effectively redefining it and narrowing it.
I haven't said what my definition is yet. This is Larissa's definition.
I
think that you will be happy there.
No, I won't do the act of Chris. I think it is just the other. I mean, the word concept was used in a very disparate ways with different meanings. And disease, as turned out to be exhibited here, is used in the same haphazard way.
So make a neologism. I mean, I have no argument with the notion of which I can sell as coming. But whether you apply a common word, whether you take an overloaded word, and I submit that disease and or concept were both overloaded, but to say that any other use is therefore incorrect.
Did I say that?
You did about concept.
My recipe with regard to concept was just stop using this word and everybody will be happy. We'll sleep better. Now, I'm not making the same argument with respect to disease. On the contrary, I'm trying to produce an understanding of disease which will be coherent and which will be consistent with the way clinical medicine understands disease, as you will see in just a minute.
Can I just continue a little bit on that? Because what is indeed is confusing, that it is not always clear when you use the word disease that you are already using it to refer to a thing that in maybe 15 slides from now on you are going to explain what it is, right? While we use the word at different occasions for different things, and nobody denies the existence of these different things, okay? But when we are not clear about it, when we use the word disease, then it gives rise to confusion. So in that sense, I understand Chris and some others
I'm sorry. I am humbled by the fact that time is linear.
I guess I'm confused actually by the comment of Chris that if part of what we're doing here is to create a formal language that's going to take away the confusion, aren't we striving for taking away the confusion? Then what's so wrong with kind of by fiat saying, you know, okay, we have to come up with something. If natural language were doing the job with all of its vagueness and generality confused or sort of squishy concepts or overlapping concepts, then maybe there would be no need to create an ontology. And so what's exactly wrong with sort of narrowing a term to the point where now we all are going to say, okay, yep, this is how we're using it. If you want to use it in some different way, you're going to have to go find yourself another term to add to the ontology because this one's already taken.
Well, in most cases, we already have other terms. I mean, so, for example, except the boundary problem, the difference between a disease and the signs and symptoms, in the majority of cases, are pretty clear. There are some cases where we agree that it's fuzzy at the edges, but in the majority of cases, it's pretty clear. And all we're trying to do, I think, is come to some common agreement for those other cases that might be more difficult.
All right, let's move on. So another problem is another.
I wonder if the signs and symptoms question is anything. I just don't accept the comment made at all.
He's like me, he's an optimist. So there is another boundary problem. If we're going to define a disease as a state that places individuals at increased risk of adverse consequences, we have to say that because of the symptoms of present drug problem too. Then what is the threshold for adverse? And there are two threshold problems here. One is the intensity dimension. So something may be adverse, but only a slight tickle. The other is the time dimension. Something may be adverse, but only for 4 minutes. So are we going to allow adverse consequences to embrace a 4 minute slight tickle? Or a 4 minute intense pain, which then goes away? So these are the questions which we have to deal with, even though they really are just threshold questions, or boundary questions. So the function of the kidney is to clean blood. Kidney is made of nephrons, which are made of segments, which have very, very specific functions like sensing and control and function, filtration and so on. These are dispositions in Neil's sense, and the dispositions are based on underlying carriers which have certain structures or shapes. And these structures or shapes are going to involve cells, which are going to be organized in highly specific ways to form reciprocally operating networks. Now, what we're going to try and do is to understand how those networks go wrong to create certain obvious examples of diseases, and we're going to follow the principle of low-hanging fruit. Now, the principle of low-hanging fruit says that we should try to understand 4 or 5 or 10 or 20 prototypical or very prevalent or very well understood diseases, understanding an ontology of them, and then move on with the help of SNOMED to create a disease ontology based upon that understanding. Now, it's been argued at various points that a good way to follow this principle would be to talk not about diseases at all, because they raise these incredibly difficult questions about normality, abnormality, adversity, harm, and so on, good and bad, which we want to avoid. But in fact, if we did talk about conditions, then we would just raise analogous threshold questions slightly further out. And if we do that, we also lose one very big and important source of knowing about diseases, which is clinical medicine. And I want to argue that the way to understand the nature of disease is in part to ask the question, what is clinical medicine for? Why do we have clinical medicine? Clinical medicine is part of reality. It goes on all the time. It's even successful some of the time. And that's because there are diseases. And if we take this reciprocity between disease and clinical medicine seriously, then perhaps we can understand disease by looking at what clinical medicine does. What is the function of clinical medicine in terms of this? Well, the answer is that it's fixing broken body parts, or it's preventing the appearance of broken body parts by stepping in at an earlier stage before the breakages happen. Or it's attempting, if it can't fix,
then at least to alleviate the harmful consequences of this malfunctioning. Any good theory of disease is going to have to do justice to this. Now, we have normal functionings at different levels, on the level of cells, on the level of molecules, on the level of bodies, organisms, organs. And then we have pathology. And I think pathology involves malfunctionings. And that we understand pathology on two levels. On the level of pathophysiology, which is studying the malfunctionings, those processes themselves. And on the level of pathoanatomy, which is understanding the things which are broken and which need fixing by clinical medicine. And the disease here gets realized in the pathophysiological processes which come about because things down here are broken. What this means is that we need pathoanatomy, and the disease ontology as it's currently constituted has a large anatomical disease hierarchy. I think that it should rather have a patho-anatomical hierarchy. So one important part of the future disease ontology should be an ontology of patho-anatomy. And then we see that there are different types of patho-anatomical structures. There are malshapen limbs, for instance, or malshapen body parts generally. There are pathological formations which grow out of other body parts like tumors. And then there are disturbed networks, which is what Neil was talking about towards the end of his presentation, and what Lou will be talking about tomorrow. Now, some patho-anatomical structures, there may be other kinds, of course, this is always the aim towards completeness. Some patho-anatomical structures are not associated with the risk of adverse consequences. So, this is just a plain fact. But some are. And those adverse consequences are where diseases are to be located, I think. They are, so diseases arise where we have patho-anatomical structures which are associated with anatomical, with adverse consequences. Now, yes?
What's the word disorders doing there?
I am tempted to get rid of it. It will just confuse. So ignore it. I'll give it to Chris. He can have that one. So, if we look at any anatomical structure in the body, we can divide it both at the physical discontinuities, the membranes or skin, or we can divide it for theoretical purposes where there are no physical discontinuities. And those second kinds of divisions we can call fiat divisions for obvious reasons. They don't reflect any discontinuity in reality, rather they reflect our demarcation chosen for our fiat purposes. So, if we have a tumor, for instance, then the tumor will be connected to the body via a fiat boundary. But the tumor is real. But it's there without having a boundary of its own. Now, Colorado is in exactly the same situation. Colorado is real. You can go there. So I understand. But it doesn't have a bona fide boundary. So there are real things which have fiat boundaries. Tumors exist. Tumors really exist. They are bad. But they are connected to the body by a fiat boundary.
They might have a real boundary.
Some. I'm talking about the attached ones.
Well, I think a pathologist would disagree.
Yeah, I think
because they do margin examination all the time.
But if you get down to the sufficiently fine level of granularity, you still won't be able to find it.
No, I disagree. If you look in a slide, you can actually see the tumor cell right next to normal cell.
And we do microdissection literally cell by cell all the time.
But a pathologist would say that the tumor is composed of malignant cells and reactive stroma.
But there's still a boundary.
Between the tumor cells and the reactive stroma, but not between the tumor and the normal tissue.
Not every tumor has a real boundary.
Good. Some have. I only need one thing. All right, so So there are different kinds of anatomical structure, and there are different kinds of pathological formations. A pathological colon is a structure, but the colon carcinoma, in virtue of which it is a pathological colon, is not an anatomical structure. You won't find this in the FMA. You will find colon in the FMA, and since a pathological colon is a colon, then this too is in the FMA, sort of. It's hiding there behind the scenes.
I like this. This is the direction we're headed anyway.
Good.
It's still there.
So, there are malgrowths, therefore. Now, Pat...
Mary.
Yes.
I just like that.
Just like...
Please go back to the last slide. It's horrible.
Well, I'm tempted therefore not to go back. We can talk about this later. I don't have so much time. So, prokaryotic organisms do not have diseases. He's shaking his head.
What about a bacterial cell infected by bacterial virus?
Okay, delete that from the record. Eukaryotic cells certainly have diseases. Or anyway, they are parts of organisms which have diseases. And that's in part because they form complex networks in virtue of the fact that, again, as Neil mentioned, we're dealing with entities which have many, many different kinds of dispositions which join together with other entities which have reciprocal dispositions to create networks. And these networks can then be damaged in various ways which we're familiar with. And then we know already that various diseases begin with changes in the structures of certain cells. We know this, we understand this through and through. And some of those changes lead to distortions in the network to which those cells belong in ways which compromise the viability of the organism. They give rise to adverse consequences of a very clear sort. And when that happens, then certainly then we can say that the organism, not just the cell, but the organism has a disease. And that there is a disease there. Everyone?
So what's the...
distortion a synonym for dysfunction here? For malfunctioning?
Actually, no. I'm trying to think now patho-anatomically. So I'm thinking of distortion as a kind of shape distortion. It's like a fracture.
So what about so what's the patho-anatomical defect in type 2 diabetes?
It's, you're asking me? So, action item now.
Insulin resistance.
If you look at the FMA or other anatomical ontologies, they do not deal with cellular networks. Cellular networks and similar kinds of complex structures, dynamically functioning structures within the body, may be very important for understanding diseases. I think they are important for understanding at least some diseases. Therefore, they should be dealt with within anatomy. And then the various different ways in which they are distorted or subject to malformations should be studied in a new discipline of network patho-anatomy. And so we extend anatomy to networks and extend patho-anatomy to types of disturbed networks.
So are you talking about like the endocrine system needs to be defined because that's a network of...
Yeah. Although we're talking now about specific subsystems within the endocrine system.
Are these networks still defined structurally, or do you want to define them via functions? Because
if I'm going to be faithful to the methodology which has proven itself in the FMA, then yes, they should be defined structurally.
But could be structurally at the level of the function of a particular molecule.
Yeah.
Though even Cornelius would admit that the demand to the structure breaks down. You get to systems.
Yes, he's actually very hesitant about including systems in the FMA for this very reason.
For this reason.
Particularly the immune system.
It is very, they are not structurally.
Yeah.
The endocrine system and the nervous system.
I am happy to have them in there. And in fact, I want more of them, in effect. That's what I'm proposing. So, Christopher Bors is a philosopher who has written several classic papers on the definition of disease, which I strongly recommend that you read. They are the loci classici, or whatever the correct grammar is, of philosophy of disease. And he, the nearest thing he comes to our present concerns can be encapsulated in this sentence: health is conformity to normal species design. For him, normal species design is statistically determined. So his theory is sometimes called a biostatistical theory of health and disease. I think that this conformity to normal species design is a very important part of the puzzle we're trying to fit together. Now, let's get back to prototypes, foci, focal instances. If you look at functions in artifacts like screwdrivers, you will find that there is an opposition between good screwdrivers which fit the screw exactly and which are very solid but the right shape and they have a nice handle. They are prototypical screwdrivers. And then we have broken screwdrivers. Screwdrivers with bent ends or screwdrivers where the handle doesn't quite hold the blade firmly. There are various different ways in which you can be a broken screwdriver, but a good screwdriver is a kind of prototype. It's the same with hearts. You have healthy hearts and you have unhealthy hearts. There are many different kinds of unhealthy hearts, but the healthy heart is a pretty standard thing. And what prototypes here are marked by is good functioning, which involves also sound anatomy. They have anatomy which conforms to the species designed for an organism of that age in that environment, and they function in the way that they should function. But then as we move out, we get to reasonable functioning. The heart is still pumping, you're still alive, you're still quite happy. But then gradually we move out towards poor functioning, and then eventually we get to malfunctioning, and then at some stage you get not functioning at all, which will lead to death unless you have two of them, or some other part can take over, or the system is not very critical, or you can go to some kind of external aid or environment. But generally speaking, not functioning at all will lead to death. Now, disease is actually around about here, I would. If you're out here, then it's too late even to be diseased. So we can ignore all of those factors and just look at this space here. Disease involves remoteness from prototypical functioning, but dispositionally only, because you could be taking symptom-suppressant drugs, so you could still be diseased, but you have a risk of non-prototypical functioning in virtue of your underlying state. Neil?
I was just curious about malfunction and the sort of slight ambiguity in the negative there.
Yes.
You seem to be reading malfunction as not functioning correctly. Couldn't something continue to perform its function like the heart does, but it also sort of produces other functions which are bad functions? So there's not functioning, and then there's producing other functions which aren't needed at all.
So I'm simplifying wildly to avoid needing to go into those kinds of details, which actually some of them were captured in Rex's definition this morning. Yes?
So I'm going back to my previous question.
Yeah?
I have a risk of scurvy if I stop eating
vitamin
C. Does that mean I'm just constantly diseased?
Yes, so I think that what you have here is a second order disposition, and diseases are first order dispositions. So we can have dispositions to have other dispositions. And you have a disposition to have the disposition to have scurvy, but you don't have the disposition. Am I doing this?
Why are you second on?
Because who asked that question? Yes. Why don't you answer this question, Neil?
There's your answer, which that's fine, which is you're sitting there in a state ready to be put into another state where that state's a disease state.
Yeah.
The other one is that normal functioning requires that one of the partners you interact with is vitamin C. And in the absence of that, you then go about it to a disease process.
Yes. So they're
sitting there waiting for the absence of vitamin C.
But production of vitamin C, I mean, that's sort of a trivial example, right? If you don't eat food, you're going to die as well. That's not a disease. I mean, it's not part of our normal process to produce vitamin C. So the absence of production of vitamin C isn't a disease because it's not part of our normal, it's not the missing
or malfunctioning in the normal process.
Good, good. So that, actually, that would help me more.
Actually, all humans are diseased because it was a normal mammalian process.
Well, okay.
We haven't to deal with time yet. We still have to deal with time.
But human is not part of the normal human process. Just as we lack all the odor receptors that we lack, and we're mutants in many ways.
Thing, in the disease definition, because it's clearly dysfunctional.
So I haven't covered all the bases yet with regard to capturing what the normality has to be in order to work.
What was the last point you made?
That clearly dysfunctional loss of processes that is demonstrable in the community of biological diversity, creating vitamin, synthesizing vitamin C is a normal process. Most organisms can do it that require it.
But it's not normal for humans.
It's not normal. We have lost it in our brilliant evolutionary trend here. We could quibble as to, even though it is normal for humans, does it remain a disease state?
And I would say that it's not, and I think I can give the reason why.
Where's the lacerated arm fit into this?
So just an arm. It's just an independent continuum.
Okay.
That's an easy one. It's a fiat independent continuum, however, because the arm is not physically discontinuous from.
I know you haven't dealt with time yet, but is getting bold a disease?
I'm coming to that.
Just let me reconfirm. Isn't there a disease associated with a lacerated arm?
But very well will be, yes. Very likely will be.
I mean, it's...
So what is the disease associated with the lacerated, you know, in the absence of infection, what is the disease?
Well, I think everybody uses exactly the same words to describe the lacerated arm, and arm laceration the disease. We don't differentiate.
Yeah, so we need to tease this one out. So it may very well be that because there is no special disease associated with lacerated arm, that people just use the same word, because that which follows the lacerated arm follows the lacerated arm, and that's all there is to be said about it.
Yeah, it's...
And it may not be a disease. It depends how we're going to treat self-healing processes.
Well, so healing is a normal process.
Yeah, so it's a question of adverse consequences, which we also still have to deal with.
Yeah, you have to, certain lacerations you have to stitch up, or they,
right,
they do all, yes, kinds of bad, yes, things. They get infected and they,
good,
don't heal.
So they are the disease cases. And okay, those bad things is what we have to describe. Yeah. And there may not be a good word for them yet, but that's your job. All right, so diseases are like functions. They are dependent continuums which get realized in certain executions or courses or histories. They are states or conditions which endure for a certain time and have a course or history which is an occurrence. And then we have disease instances like Mary's pneumonia, and then we have occurrent instances, the course of Mary's pneumonia. In all of this, we need to take time into account. So a 40-year-old man with rapidly dividing, highly invasive cancerous prostate cells has the disease, prostate cancer. A 90-year-old man with slowly dividing cancerous prostate cells does not have the disease, prostate cancer. All right?
I think we would not agree with that. That's a tough one.
That's a clinical call, but yeah. I agree with that.
Good. So I said you would be happier as the time went on. So, the FMA is a canonical representation, but it recognizes also variant anatomical structures. This is the lobes of lung question. So, not every normal human being has exactly the same number of X's and Y's. They are just variants. Now, what I want to do is to make a great leap from anatomy to physiology. Anatomy is about the bowel plan of an organism, the building plan, the organization. I want to talk about life plans. And I want to say that there are normal life plans, and then there are variant life plans, and then there are pathological life plans. Now, variant life plans would be vegetarians, for instance. Or if you don't like vegetarian, choose another example. Pathological life plans would be the life plans of serial murderers, for example. Now,
or meat eaters?
Well, I
thought that was a completely harmless example, but anyway, it's very, very difficult to talk about these things, but I'm going to do my best. Now, just as there are 2×n canonical bow plans for human beings, according to how many stages you do the representation of the anatomy, so there are going to be many different canonical life plans for different types of human beings in different types of contexts. So males and females are going to have different canonical life plans. But we'll share many things too. So to determine what the canonical life plans are is going to be quite difficult. But that doesn't mean that we can't use this notion in order to help us understand what disease is. There are many things which every human life involves. So 9 months of development, according to a very determinate plan, is present there for everybody. And then going through various phases of birth and infancy and waking and sleeping, eating and not eating, they're present for everybody. In fact, we can make a list. So 30% of the time, on average, we sleep, 5% we eat, 1% we drink, we void, we sex, we work, we rest, we talk, we do motor practices, we anger, and so on. These have all been measured more or less. You can deviate from these things, but you shouldn't deviate too much, particularly not from the eating. Now, according to traditional definitions of function, a biological entity has a function if it's part, if that entity, a kidney for instance, has a disposition to act reliably in such a way as to contribute to the organism's survival. Now the problem with this definition is that it doesn't apply to reproductive organs or sperm, because sperm don't act reliably to contribute to your survival, and most of them don't act reliably anyway. So, and it doesn't apply to the carcinomatous lung, certainly. The carcinomatous lung still has a function. And there are various other reasons why this definition does not work and why it's not helpful if we want to understand disease. But we can revise it. We can say an entity has a biological function if it's part of an organism and has a disposition to act reliably in such a way as to contribute to the organism's realization of the canonical life plan for an organism of the relevant species. And now it's part of the canonical life plan that we have sperm that do their thing. And it might be part of the canonical life plan that we die, for instance. And now we go back to the question, what is canonical medicine for? Canonical medicine is to bring the patient back in the direction of the canonical life plan for an organism of whatever is the specific act, whatever is the specific stage of development. So your clinician is not going to try and cure you of prostate cancer if you are a 90-year-old man who has just had prostate problems detected, because it's not that wouldn't bring you any nearer to the canonical life plan. If you're 40, then it would bring you nearer to the canonical life plan. So, and to cure is to pull you all the way back to the canonical life plan. And extending life would be to take you somehow beyond, in a kind of Arnold Schwarzenegger type way, the canonical life plan. So, we want to understand adverse consequences. Adverse consequences are those things which clinicians try and do something about. They are falling short of the canonical life plan. We're trying to do this neutrally. So we can't use good and bad. So,
didn't you just move the problem? Because now we have the big question whether homosexuality is part of the...
And that's why it's good that we have clinical medicine. So does clinical medicine try to cure homosexuality? Does evidence-based medicine try and do X, Y, and Z?
They tried some years ago.
Yeah, they failed. And that this is a reflection of the advance of science. We're learning more about what we can cure and about what we should cure. We're learning more about what the canonical life plan is. But also the canonical life plan changes according to the environmental conditions, the technology that we have.
Does that mean if we don't have a cure for it, it isn't a disease?
No, but we're trying to understand what the adverse consequences are. And in order to understand the adverse consequences, we have to look at what clinical medicine tries to do. What does clinical medicine try to do? When people have fallen short of the canonical life plan, it tries to take them back. It doesn't always know how to do that. And in those cases where we have a disease but we don't know how to take people back to the canonical life plan, we still have a disease, because you can bet your life that clinical medicine is trying to find a cure.
But one of your examples for a pathological life plan was a serial killer. You don't treat them, especially not in the US. You kill them. That's not...
maybe I need a better example. All right, so let's try and summarize. A disease involves the following. Each anatomical structure in an organism has a certain function, let's suppose, and this structure has become pathological because of growths or pathogens or some genetically determined deformations or for whatever reason, in such a way that it malfunctions in ways which fall outside the species' typical range for an organism in that state of development, which means that it falls outside the canonical life plan and thereby brings a high risk of adverse consequences. So you can fall outside the canonical life plan by doing too much ontology, for instance. But that does not have adverse consequences.
Well,
that may be debatable.
Okay, so this brings me back to my question about getting older. So you accumulate mutations as you get older.
Yeah.
Those bring you a high risk of adverse consequences at some point as you continue to accumulate them.
Yeah, and this is part of what I'm trying to do with this canonical life plan business. As you get older, the canonical life plan takes account of this accumulation of mutations. So, and you, therefore bringing you back to the canonical life. Sorry?
It's now normal to accumulate mutations?
I'm trying to avoid using the word normal. Although I do use the word canonical, which I confess is a sin. He thinks it's better. Neil?
Doesn't a wild man die at like 38 or something?
That's because of the evil influence of Western civilization.
It would be canonical, like if you had lots and lots of other people to compare them against. But somehow, in an unusual situation, he was put in that condition, then he wouldn't cause another problem. Isn't that true?
But
something about in a certain environment.
Yeah, of course. What is a canonical life plan will depend upon the environment that you're in, or your culture is in. So, disease is around about here. Disease is remoteness from prototypical functioning, modulo the stage of the development and the environment. So I got that one.
And so now we can approximately relate to a 95% confidence interval?
I think that's built into the notion of canonical. But I agree that that needs work.
I'm sorry, do you just say that what is a canonical life plan depends also on the culture?
I'm afraid it might, yes.
So whether homosexuality is a disease is not an objective.
I really
it
do
might
not.
Be, it, might be it might be a disease in Iraq, but it's not in the US.
Yeah, I don't like that either. But
that
I don't think
that's horrible if you want to embrace a realistic point of view.
Yes, so
thought you would.
Yes, so I really don't know what to say about this. I very deliberately formulated the list of things which happened in the canonical life plan in such a way that it was that I was avoiding all the tricky questions. So I agree.
That's why I'm here. I'm asking them.
Well,
I
stop
want
it.
You to...
All right. So let's the disease now.
But in fairness, it's not that you really disagree with where he's going with this. What you're troubled by is that there are different cultural responses to homosexuality, which is different. I mean, it's his method still can apply.
No,
we have this idea of canonical behavior.
No,
I think
proposing a solution where he takes all the problems which he's seen before and pushes them to the kind of this wild term which is called canonical life.
I think I can do the Iraq case. So homosexual behavior, let's suppose, does not have the risk of adverse consequences.
It does.
It does in Iraq, but not for reasons which have to do with the underlying physicochemical causality that is involved, for instance, in Alzheimer's disease. So I'm going to say this departure brings causally a risk of adverse consequences for X. And I could even make it stronger in order to avoid the statistical prevalence of AIDS, for instance, in a given culture. by saying that it brings causally and internally. So the Alzheimer's disease happens all by itself inside you. You don't need to be part of the culture. So anyway, so the definition goes like this, and it's now Fabian free. X has a, Fabian proof, I should say. X has a disease means X departs from the canonical life plan appropriate for X's stage of development and environment, and this departure brings causally and internally a risk of adverse consequences for X, and this departure is rooted in an enduring patho-anatomical distortion.
What about psychiatric?
This fits beautifully, psychiatric disease.
And the path
yeah, it's this is yeah. A cellular network.
Wiring of the brain.
Wiring.
Oh, it works. I think brain damage.
So, and then in response to Kent's objection to Neil's earlier version of this same thought, we do not need to know the nature of the pathological patho-anatomical distortion in every type of case in order to apply this definition. We can know that it's rooted in an enduring patho-anatomical distortion if we accept this definition of disease. It's trivial. If we decided that this person has a disease. But we don't need to know which one it is. That it may take 5, 10, or 15 years before we know that.
But the distinction depends on our decision about what we think about where it's rooted.
But so long as you accept that every disease has some sort of physical basis, then you're okay with it.
Right, but for example, I'm trying to think of some examples where you have to sort of accept on faith that this in fact does. Let's take chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yeah.
There's a group of people who believe that has an enduring patho-anatomical distortion, and a group of people who believe it doesn't. That it's malingering combined with something else.
Actually, there was a decision about that last week, so it's now a disease.
And what was the basis of the conclusion that it's a disease? That they found a physical basis?
That they don't have a physical basis.
It was voted.
Okay, yeah.
So just like Pluto was no longer a planet, that's the same kind of decision.
So I think I only have 2 minutes. Actually, no. It looks as if I have infinite amounts of time.
What about sickle cell
anemia? Oh, that's a hard one. And every definition of disease is going to have problems at the boundaries. We're following the principle of low-hanging fruit. Well, we make
one
this
environment is a disease, and another environment.
No, I'm just looking at the definition.
I haven't done any work at all on this.
It's a disease in all cases. If you are homozygous sickle. You've got a disease. If you're heterozygous sickle,
I don't want to know about the disease. I want to test this definition because he said it's Fabian.
Yeah, and I said I haven't done any work on this phrase here. So that I agree that needs more.
Okay.
But that is not a good example because it doesn't matter what environment you're in. If you sickle, you're going to get sick.
I just wanted to show a test case because according to this definition, it's not a disease.
It is absolutely a disease if you're in Africa.
According to his definition, not
according to his definition, it is. I mean, it's still a disease.
Yeah.
No.
Right?
It's actually
please go sick. Please go back.
An adaptive trait.
Just get back. Assume I'm a black. I'm in Africa where there's malaria. Then it will have the departure will not bring the risk of adverse consequences.
Yes, so X doesn't
it will
have
be actually it will be good for me. So
homozygote. Right. If you're homozygote, you're going to still be sick.
Right. So heterozygotes that have the advantage with respect to malaria.
And heterozygotes don't have the disease.
They do not have sickle cell anemia. They just have the sickle cell gene. They're carriers, and therefore they have an advantage against malaria, a small advantage. But sickle cell disease is a disease
that under different conditions a thing could be a disease or could be beneficial.
So maybe the one to think about that's better is energy metabolism. People that have abundant food supply versus people that don't have an abundant food supply. It's simply a matter of the environment you find yourself in.
Okay, I would like to finish though. So the implications for the disease ontology, Rex. We should focus on specific focal families of diseases and work those out clearly rather than trying to do the whole thing. And we should focus on those cases where we can specify relevant patho-anatomical entities, including cellular networks and types of disturbance. So we should focus on the patho things. And indeed, I believe that that a single hierarchy, single inheritance classification of diseases might be obtained by looking at the types of patho-anatomical disturbance which patho-anatomical structures are susceptible to. That's a hypothesis. And so we follow in this principle of low-hanging fruit. We have human beings do it. We don't try and look to the NCI thesaurus in order to work out what cancer is. We talk to real human experts. And we have it validated by other human experts. And then we take the structure that this yields, and we work with SNOMED, for instance, in order to create the further content that we need. And Colorado exists. We're talking now about abnormality rooted in generalized patho-anatomy, and disease is some subdomain of this, which is in turn some subdomain of this, because not every enduring phenotypic abnormality is an abnormality rooted in generalized patho-anatomy, and not every one of these things is a disease. Every one of these borders involves an element of fiat. What is abnormal is going to involve an element of fiat. Well, it depends on what we care about. It depends on the technology we have, the food supply, and so on. Even what is an enduring phenotypic abnormality is subject to that fiat problem. But just because we're dealing with a fiat doesn't mean that the thing does not exist and that it can't be studied in useful ways. Yes?
Could you go back to the previous slide? No, the multicolored one. Yeah, that one. Okay, so are you saying that every instance of a disease is an instance of patho-anatomy?
It's an instance of an abnormal... propensity, I think, is the word I'm looking for. It's an instance of a propensity rooted in abnormal patho-anatomy. In this generalized sense, which...
I think this is a key point. What do you mean by anatomy? Because from my point of view, there are diseases where the anatomy is normal. It is genes that are misregulated. They're completely normal,
yeah,
and yet they are not expressing correctly, and the networks and pathways,
yeah,
that devolve from,
yeah,
there are abnormal.
Yeah.
There's
so,
no abnormal structure. Anatomy.
Yeah, so I said that we had an action item. I don't know whether that is the appropriate action item, but what I'm trying to say here can be conveyed in terms of this action item, namely, we take anatomy. We want to understand disease. I think all diseases have some physical basis. Sometimes the physical basis is some kind of malformed limb or laceration. Sometimes the physical basis is a distorted cellular network. Sometimes it's something wrong with gene regulation.
Cellular network is a classification of anatomy.
There isn't anatomy in the network.
Not yet. This is an action item. We need to...
It's just an interesting point of view, because from my point of view, a cellular network is it's a physiology, it's a process. I myself don't happen to view a cellular network as an anatomy.
Yeah, so...
Some people take anatomy to the molecular level.
Yes, absolutely.
So
yes.
There are two issues here.
There's more than one group.
Yeah, there are two issues here. One is granularity. So we have molecular networks, genetic regulation networks, cellular networks of various kinds. We have the immune system, which is a network, even at a higher level. So that's one level. I think anatomy should go all the way down. And that's just use of words. But now we have another level, which is single object anatomy, organs, cells, molecules, and then anatomy, which would encompass also complex objects working together. Now, a system or a set of cells working together, I want to call a cellular network. Now, you prefer to see that as being something physiological rather than anatomical. I think that my way of understanding it has the following advantage. So do you think that your car, I presume that you have a car.
Yes, I
didn't
want.
Do you think it has a hydraulic system?
Yes.
Does it have it now?
Yes.
But it's not functioning, it's inert now. It's the same system which, later in the day, will become dynamic, will do things. So So the system endures even when it's switched off. Now similarly, cellular networks, I think, endure even when they're switched off. And therefore they're not processes. Sorry, they are the things...
I don't want to waste a lot of time on that. What you're saying makes perfect sense. I just don't necessarily agree. I'd be happy to talk about it another time.
Barry has a tendency to redefine words to make them mean what he wants.
Yeah.
But if you call this patho-anatomy and pathophysiology...
Certainly we need to do pathophysiology.
Then you'd be okay.
So I don't think that anything that you want to say about cellular networks is going to get lost. It's just a question of what we regard the ontology of cellular network to be. And I'm happy to give you that phrase if you can give me an alternative.
Like I said, I don't want to derail the
Yeah, story. Actually this is the end, practically speaking. So that's the last slide. So, Werner?
Yeah, well, you have been very clever in your slides in avoiding to write what the disease is. So even in your...
I know. I was.
Okay, but I'm also a player, so I don't. But in the very end, on that question, you said it is a propensity.
Yeah.
And if I understood Neil well, then a propensity is a disposition which has some statistical notion.
Yeah.
So is that your current working definition?
Actually, I'm not so much concerned about the statistical issue here, I'm concerned about drugs. Or other kinds of interventions. So you can still have a disease even if you are not showing any of the abnormal manifestations because you take drugs.
I agree with that.
That's my main focus, actually. Mm-hmm.
And but the working definition would be disposition or propensity or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, okay, it is a propensity. So it might come a situation that certain disease does not exist at all anymore.
Yep.
If that for a long enough time, then the statistics associated with the propensity is zero. Right?
Yep.
I had in mind that as a universal level, once a universal, always a universal,
no.
Until eternity.
No.
Is that not right?
No.
So universals can stop.
If all human beings are annihilated in the nuclear holocaust,
yeah.
Forever, irreversibly, then all diseases would cease to exist, and all disease universals would cease to exist. Yeah, all human disease universals.
And the universal human would cease to exist?
Yeah. That's... So, Alan?
I'm one of the things that worries me about this is what follows from it. And I understand this is a scoping exercise, but is there any do we have any evidence that the best way to approach describing pathophysiology is to start with disease, or to start at some other point? There undoubtedly are things which are abnormal, etc. But is the best way to describe what something is, if this is ontology, to start with the notion of disease, or is that merely a way of scoping which things we focus on?
Actually, my goal, and I think this is part of the goal of this workshop, and certainly should be, was to try and help people like Rex, who are trying to build disease ontologies for specific reasons that they have confronted in their work. And one of the OBO founding principles is that every ontology in the OBO foundry should have a clear definition of its scope, its domain. So scoping. Now, specifically with regard to disease ontology, what should a disease ontology be about? And that's what I was trying to establish.
And so it should not be about signs and symptoms?
I think that signs and symptoms are becoming increasingly irrelevant.
They're separate.
We've had this issue come back, and I've returned on this. Signs and symptoms are clearly roles. The same phenomenon can be a sign, I can see it. It can be a symptom, the patient can report it. In that strong clinical sense in which doctors use sign and symptom, it can be disease, or it can at least be something which I label the patient with in the diagnostic heading. Mm-hmm. So that clearly for sign and symptom, attempting to separate them. We've got 20 years of experience that this is a complete waste of time and counterproductive.
Yeah.
And I suspect on the whole it is with disease as well. That the I think you have to argue very strongly to say diseases, I'm quite happy to use abnormal or something else as a role for some of these phenomena or as some way of labeling certain phenomena. But I wonder if that's the place to start. And as a scoping tool, but getting too worried about an absolute definition of what a disease is.
You need that if you're going to build a disease ontology. Now, it could be that we recommend to Rex that he stops doing it.
You need that scope, which portions of a larger ontology you include in a disease ontology.
Well, but on the other hand, with regard to signs and symptoms, it should be said that we're now making, I think, impressive progress with the PATO ontology in producing a framework within which we can do justice to what earlier was referred to under the headings of signs and symptoms. Stefan?
Yeah.
I think we should make this the last question.
Yeah. I have two questions.
First
one, I think your proposal is more or less conclusive, but of course we have to forget many things which we read in textbooks, for instance, that classical pneumonia has four phases, and so...
No, you shouldn't forget anything.
This is about disease courses and not about diseases. Disease process.
Yes.
So you exclude deliberately. So you should
modify slightly what you read if you read that diseases have phases.
Yeah.
The typical course of the disease has phases.
Yeah. And the second thing is, would you agree that according to your definition, disease is not really an ontological category because you brought this notion of canonical life into your deliberations, and I think it's quite logical, and it may explain why we disagree about what is disease.
Because in Germany they have.
Yeah, it requires some authority. Defines what is a canonical life.
Good. So I said there are many different canonical lives, just as there are many different canonical anatomies. I think that canonical anatomy is proving and will continue to prove absolutely indispensable for doing good ontology, just as the gene ontology is a canonical ontology, it was indispensable. And the reason is that if you start with conditions in general, including the pathological ones and the non-pathological ones smudged together in a single continuum, you will get nowhere because you will have no reference from which to hang all the deviations. So we need to produce canonical ontologies for each domain in order that we can do the patho-ontology job. And I'm going to let you just have one last word. I saw you earlier.
Well, I wanted to go to this canonical life plan as well. I think this makes your presentation very different from the other presentation today because it's going beyond ontology. And you must accept at least some kind of value expression.
Canonical anatomy doesn't say that if you have exactly the right number of teeth, you're somehow a better person.
Yeah, but when you want to distinguish between this top 10 of lung diseases, or what we saw in the very first presentation, from other dispositions and dysfunctions, malfunctions, you need to have a kind of dependency to this canonical life plan. I think the point is that you need to integrate the clinical situation, the situation of the patient, and the cultural background of these because of the different boundaries.
Yeah, so I sort of agree with you, but I still think that I have a simpler recipe which will take us a long way for the beginning stages of this, which is that you look at what clinical medicine tries to do. If clinical medicine tries to move people in a certain direction, then that means that they are away from the canonical lifetime, which is relevant for clinical medicine. And it's that canonical lifetime which is relevant for understanding disease, at least at the beginning. When we have a good disease ontology, we can then start to think about more subtle questions having to do with diseases which seem to be culturally I don't think we can have any more questions otherwise. But we can continue talking, so I propose that we now break. Thank you.
I think we discussed.